All right, good afternoon, everybody. If you take your seats, we do have a quorum. And I call this meeting of the House of Education Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. Seeing as there is a quorum, we need to approve the minutes from Tuesday, March 5th. Has anybody had time to look at those minutes? Representative Hewitt, would you please move the minutes and approve Tuesday, March 5th?
Madam Chair, I would. Please move the minutes.
Representative Hewitt moves approval of the minutes for Tuesday, April 5th. Any discussions? March 5th? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for Tuesday, March 5th are approved. First up, we have House File 1883, Representative Katiza Watoon's bill on foster care student enrollment in school required and foster youth school enrollment report required. Representative, may I have a motion to get Representative Katiza Watoon's bill before the committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
We have the bill before us, and I refer House File 1883 to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. Representative Katiza Watoon, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm grateful for the opportunity to present here in education policy today. I'm here to speak to the critically important issue of making sure that all children, especially in Minnesota, have the right to access high-quality education. For those of you who don't know, I'm a current licensed foster parent in Hennepin County. I'm adopting three children out of the foster care system in the state of Minnesota. So this is a personal issue to me, really important for our young children across the state of Minnesota. Though Minnesota is a leader in many aspects of the education system, one area where we're falling behind nationally is ensuring that our most vulnerable children, those specifically in foster care, have access and are enrolled in school. Currently, the federal Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, states that every youth entering foster care should stay in their home school, but if unable, should be immediately enrolled in a new school. The definition of immediately is up to interpretation and not clearly defined in either federal or state statute, so we're hoping to make some progress on that. This bill would change immediately to be within 7 school days, and if they're not able to stay in their school of origin. So anecdotally, some of my testifiers are going to speak to the fact that we hear that children are not getting enrolled in school quickly when they have to change school districts, and that we don't have the information that we need to address that problem. We really have no idea how frequently this is happening, so the reporting piece of the bill will ensure that when children are not being enrolled within that 7 school day period, that we know that's an issue and then how to address it as a state. So I'm now going to turn it over to Wong Murphy, the Executive Director of Foster Advocates, and he can speak a little bit more to his experience in this. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Wong Murphy. I'm the Executive Director and Founder of Foster Advocates. So I'm here to speak today because I was in the foster care system. I was in foster care when I was 8 years old. I had first enrolled in school, and it was 3rd grade. It was my first time ever being in school. And I don't mean my first day. I mean, like, literally, I'd never been in a school building before. Teachers immediately recognized that I was a kid that was in danger, that I needed help. And within 4 days, I was enrolled in foster care. A teacher saved my life. And I mean that quite literally. It saved my life, and I was able to later be adopted. I was able to then move on and live a life of my own choosing. I was able to graduate high school. I was able to go to college, get my master's, become a teacher. And I was able to work at the Federal Department of Education. These are all things were possible because I was able to go to school. And so I'm here to speak to you about just the critical importance of making sure that foster children have access to a rigorous and quality education. Because the system worked exactly as it should have for me. But I didn't realize that this wasn't the norm. I just got lucky. Not every foster kid goes on to have the opportunities that I went on to have. In fact, most don't. Children who enter foster care in the U.S. are typically 6 and will stay in for 2 years, but that length will stay increasing with age. These children are twice as likely to be absent from school as other children and are 3 times more likely to be expelled. And only 50% will graduate high school on time. Part of that is because they're missing school. I was forced to repeat the 5th grade when I was being placed for adoption because I had spent 2 months out of school. I made up for it in college, but it could have easily been the end of my story. Like so many other people who failed to graduate high school, they're more likely to enter the criminal justice system, more likely to be dependent on government aid. These are all things that are not true for me because I was able to attend school. So we have the chance today to correct this. We have the chance to maintain educational stability for our most vulnerable children and youth. We have the chance to help children who are in foster care. So I urge you to keep foster kids in school by supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. And we have a second testifier, Ms. Snyder.
Hello. Thank you so much, Chair. I'm Christy Snyder. I work for Project for Pride and Living. I am the LEAP director, which stands for Learn and Earn to Achieve Potential. In my work, I get to work with county-involved youth, those in foster care and those in juvenile justice, and young people experiencing homelessness, ages 15 to 24. With that population, approximately one-third of our population is young people currently or formerly in foster care. And the reason why they come to our program that is located in alternative schools is because they're significantly behind in academic credits. The reason why we have a variety of different systems, every district has a different way of coding credits. They is not cohesive at all across. So young people, when they switch schools, necessarily often lose those credits. And so that delays their high school graduation. We see this all of the time, that young people come into our program, have been out of school for some time, even transferring within the same district, they can lose their credits. That delays their graduation. And every time a young person is held back in that way, it delays their possibility of graduation, which then young people give up hope. And so it becomes a snowball effect of what happens to young people and what they think about their professional future and where they can land in their careers. I was a nationally board certified teacher, so I also have the perspective of a teacher in addition to this new role I have. And you know that when young people are leaving school and then come back into school, it takes a long time to even socialize, to stabilize into a school. And so if you factor in that young people are out of school, have to come back into school before they can even start to feel comfortable enough to figure out the academic ways of the world of their new school and to start to earn credit, it is a huge impact that we have. And so while I appreciate ESSA and all that it is bringing so that we're thinking about this population strategically and making sure these young people get what they deserve, we need to make sure that we're very careful at delineating what that time out of school could be. 7 school days is a good enough period of time for us to be able to make sure that young people have the opportunity to land in their home and figure out what their next steps should be. So I am really appreciative of the bill that you're bringing forward, and I think that this is going to have a meaningful impact on the community that I get to serve and to work with daily. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Snyder. At this time, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? All right. Members, do you have any questions for Representative Katia Watun?
You'll get there, Madam Chair.
I did it 2 times really well. No? All right. Well, thank you, Representative. I renew my motion that House File 1883 be referred to the Health and Human Service Policy Committee. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 1883 is referred to the Health and Human Service Policy Committee.
Thank you.
All right. Next. Next up, we are going to do something a little bit different. We are going to hear Representative Poppy and Representative Bennett and Representative Gunther's bills all at the same time. Members, we're going to start with House File 692. And then we will go to House File 246. And then we will go to House File 1982. Oops, excuse me, House File 73. So, Representative Poppy, when you are ready, you... you can make your motion. Where is it? May I have your motion, members? May I have your motion to get Representative Poppy's bill before the committee? All right. Representative Baker moves House File 692 before the committee. We have the bill before us. I move to refer House File 692 to Ways and Means. Representative Poppy, would you please explain your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And what you have before us is a Southern Minnesota contingent, a bipartisan approach to an issue that we have in Southern Minnesota, and it's regarding our students and making sure that they are able to get a full spectrum of education, including CTE, the career tech ed courses. I personally work as a college counselor, so I work with students who are sometimes undecided about what their career goals are, and sometimes they don't have a full understanding of what they might like or what they don't like because they haven't had exposure to different activities, or they're not able to take classes that might spark an interest for them. So what we're, I think, attempting to do, at least I'll speak to my bill, the first bill, is to allow students to be able to get some career tech ed in with their other classes beyond the school day. So I think we all have the same people here to speak to the issue, but I will turn it over to Superintendent Brown.
Madam Chairwoman, my name is Joseph E. Brown, Sr. I'm superintendent at Fairmont Area Schools, and I just want to point out that I serve in Representative Gunther's district, I live in Representative Bennett's district, and I can honestly say I can see Representative Poppy's district from my front porch. I live on the Maurer-Freeborn County line, and Peggy's district is on the left side of the road, and Representative Poppy's district is on the right side.
You've got a trifecta there, then.
Right. And but I'm glad to be here, and thank you so much. This is a very important bill, not only for South Central Minnesota, but all across the state. Minnesota is in great need of skilled workers. We need thousands of them. I'm going to be 68 years old next year. Someday I'm going to retire. And a lot of folks that are my age have already retired if they're in the trades. Well, just as Minnesota is currently experiencing a severe teaching shortage, it is expected that there will be a more serious shortage of skilled workers in the next 3 to 5 years in carpenters, welders, electricians, and plumbers. But what is the problem? Why are students not taking vocational classes? There's many reasons for this. The answer might be that many high schools have simply eliminated vocational programs with an increased emphasis on preparing students for a four-year college experience. Schools have found it increasingly difficult to recruit and retain certified vocational teachers. And schools have cut vocational programs due to lack of funding for up-to-date equipment and facilities. We have observed that many students do not have time in their regular schedule to take a vocational class. And so a lot of that is due to the fact that we have more standards than ever before, more required classes. We have some students that are extremely top-notch students in our school. And I have an example, the third page of my packet, I have two examples of class schedules. One is Anna Nordquist, and one is Lucas Denny, is a student who's to my left. If you look at Anna Nordquist's schedule, I'll just go through it real quickly. She's taking 5 college classes, Spanish 4, and she plays cello in the orchestra. Her 7-period day is full, and yet she's one of our best welders. And she's taken the Saturday welding class 3 times, and she'll be competing this year at the Riverland Community College welding, and hopefully, Gene, she'll come back with a trophy, or at least our school will. We also have Lucas Denny with us, and Lucas also is a senior student this year, and Lucas has a full schedule. He's got a flexible learning time the first hour, but he spends that hour working with Mr. Bodine in the automotive shop and in the welding academy. We also have students that may have failed a class somewhere along the line, and now they have to take 2 classes of biology or 2 sections of history. They jam their schedule. There's no time in the regular school day. So at the same time that our state needs more skilled workers, we don't have enough time in the regular school day to get them trained. But Fairmont and our school board has been willing over the last 4 years to offer vocational classes in the evening, in the summer, and on the weekends. That's the good news. The bad news is we don't get any state aid for that. We don't generate any state aid, and that's basically what we're asking for. Well, Fairmont Area Schools has implemented summer welding classes and Saturday welding classes in addition to summer ag classes. I wrote here that currently we have 20 students. This is actually from last year, but last year we had 20 students taking this 15-week, 4-hour-a-day class. 11 students were from Blue Earth Area, which is our competitor in football. 3 students from Grenada Huntley East Chain, students from Fairmont, and 4 adults. It had 5 women and 15 men. This summer right now, Bob, if I can recall, we have 12 adults taking the class and 8 students. And the students represent public schools and private schools that come in. Now, these are kids that get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, drive 30 to 40 miles to come to Fairmont to take a 4-hour welding class. And we're fortunate that in our part of the state, as in many parts of the state, I'm sure in all of your districts, you have great kids. But we really have great kids in South Central Minnesota that are willing to get up early in the morning and go and take these classes. Well, Minnesota is blessed with a variety of manufacturing plants that are crying out for skilled workers. We need welders, we need turret lathe operators, we need carpenters, plumbers, and electricians. And I do not believe that this bill is very expensive, and let me tell you why I suggest that's true. First of all, very few Minnesota schools still have vocational programs for the trades. There's very few of us left. Second of all, there's not that many teachers like Mr. Bonin who's willing to come in on a Saturday or spend the summer teaching. And thirdly, we have a limited number of students across the state that are willing to take a class outside of the regular school day. But the fact is, we do need these folks. And I do think that we should consider somewhere down the road in the future, this is my guess, is that I think vocational teachers should be on a 12-month contract. We're losing too many of our certified vocational teachers to the private sector. You know, if you can get out of college with a certified, first of all, we only have 1 college now in the state that certifies vocational teachers. We used to have many more. We only have 1 left in Minnesota. But if you do get a certified teaching job, do you want to start at $40,000 a year teaching, or do you want to go and make a really, really good living working in the trades? Well, to get a certified vocational teacher, we may have to start hiring these people 12 months. Therefore, we must have schools. By the way, our students are only in school 14.7% of the year. 85.3% of the time, students aren't in public school. And it drives me crazy as an administrator to think that we build these multi-million dollar facilities and only use them 14.7% of the year to teach. 85.3% of the time, we shut them down. And the vocational classes are expensive to have, and if we're going to have them, we need to open them up in the evenings and in the summer. But yet, Minnesota Department of Ed does not give us any funding for that, and that's what we're asking for. On the 4th page of this packet, I do have a little cost-benefit analysis here. Even with this funding, and again, there's 3 different versions. I'll kind of go over all three of the bills, because all 3 of the bills would be fine with me. As a superintendent, my philosophy is just show me the money. And so whether it comes directly from the State Department of Ed in Representative Bennett's bill with a grant, or in Representative Gunther's bill, or Representative Poppy's bill, it is from extended time revenue. But in the extended time revenue cost-benefit analysis on page 4 of the packet, it points out that the most that a school could generate at 20% on top of the $5,117 base formula is $1,023. Well, our welding class is for 60 instructional hours. So that means we generate $284.28 for 1 student to take that class on Saturday. With 20 students, and we do have 20 welding booths at Fairmont, with 20 students, that generates $5,685. The actual cost of our class is $9,482. So even with this contribution, we still would not have enough money to actually fully fund the class, but it would still help. And then the cost, remember last year when we talked about this bill last year, we've been working on this bill for the last 3 years, I think, Representative Bennett. And I remember last time I saw the fiscal note, and the fiscal note was kind of high, and I estimated down here at the bottom that if 1,000 students use all 216 hours that they could generate under the extended time revenue, it would cost the state $1,023,000. Now think about it, though. If you had 1,000 new skilled workers that could go into the workforce and work right out of school, and Bob's going to tell a story about we have 12 of our students right now that are 19 and 20 years old working as full-time welders in Fairmont, and they're making a pretty good living, driving a nicer car than I have. Those are my opening comments, and when you read through the rest of this packet, you'll notice there's a letter I sent to the Commissioner of Education kind of pleading our case. There are some news articles there from the Fairmont Sentinel about the success of our welding academy, and at the very last two pages are recent articles from the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which talk about the fact that we have a huge labor crisis in Minnesota right now. And finally, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank also is acknowledging that with the economy looking like it might start slowing down, that his biggest concern is not so much the unemployment rate, it's the non-employment rate. And even in South Central Minnesota, we talk that we only have a 2.5% unemployment rate. But we all know that the non-employment rate is much higher. We have a lot of folks that are just not working, and mainly because they're not maybe trained or not skilled. And yet we have schools like Fairmont, and there's other great schools across the state that are willing to do this and get more skilled workers into the workforce this year. And the reason why this bill is important is that we're in the process right now of setting up our master schedule for next year. We are going to go ahead and continue to have summer classes this summer. It'd be great if the legislature would consider funding this so that we could get some additional revenue, because we're going to expand this. And I know that this will be of benefit, and it's going to be one of those areas that, you know, it's an investment now, but it's going to pay off dividends in the future. We will get more skilled workers to be working here in Minnesota, making good living, and it's going to be great for business, great for industry, and great for labor. I'm going to yield. Oh, the difference of the three bills, can I talk about the three bills real quick? Or do you want to procedurally put all three?
Go ahead, Superintendent.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm a former state senator from Iowa, and so if I start acting like a legislator, I apologize.
Well, just don't come up here and grab the gavel.
I won't do that. I was the chair of the committee.
Okay. There we go.
Okay. No, seriously, the three bills are very good. Like I said, Representative Poppy's bill is a bill that would allow extended time revenue, and it actually prioritizes which fields would be funded, and that was good. The last time we were here a year ago, it was very general CTE, vocational, and now we've really drilled it down to what is our need in our state. We need welders. We need construction workers. We need mechanics. We need plumbers. We need electricians. And then eventually we need folks going into the food service and agriculture. Representative Bennett bill is a bill that funds it a little bit differently. It simply would be a grant coming from the state. And that money, if you notice, there's no dollar amount in that. And I know how sensitive dollars are in any legislative session, especially right now. But if there's a dollar amount set aside in that in the Finance Committee and it went all the way through the legislature, then the Department of Ed would, my understanding is that we would apply for grants after we actually did the program, and they get paid for that. And Representative Gunther's bill is a little different in that it not only would allow extended time revenue for vocational programs, but also for STEM programs. And that was an amendment that got passed in the Senate last year, I think, by Senator Claussen. Is there a Senator Claussen in the Senate? And my only concern about that is that that really does make it really a broad bill and might be too expensive. So I would ask that if you kind of take all three bills and as you work in committee to put something together that really focuses on the hard skills first. That might be the first step for the next biennium, and to take care of the needs that our businesses and industries are asking for, the machinists, the welders, the construction workers, the electricians, and the carpenters.
Well, thank you, Superintendent Brown. I think next you wanted to have Mr. Bonin share his story, or?
You want to go first? I think, well, I think we'll have the students speak first, and then I'll follow up.
Okay. If you would step up to the microphone, introduce yourself so we have it on record, and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
My name is Lucas Denny, and I'm currently a senior at Fairmont High School. And I've been in a shop class every year since my ninth grade year when I've been able to take them. And up until this year, I've mostly been in small engines, automotive, things like that. And up until this year, I didn't really have any plans for after high school, didn't know what I wanted to do. I was pretty undecided. And first semester this year, I took an intro to welding class. Didn't really know anything about welding, you know, knew some of the things. And just took it and figured, you know what, I might as well just give it a shot. And about 6 weeks into it, I could really see myself getting good at it. And I just kept working at it. And it's something that's really opened my eyes to, you know, what I could do after high school. There's places in my hometown that want me to come work for them because of my ability to weld. And it's something that I never would have known I had if I wouldn't have taken the class and given it a shot. So it's really been an eye-opening experience that is just, you know, I went from not knowing what I wanted to do, now I've kind of got a plan, a course of action, and I mean, it's something that I could either continue my education at a technical college, or I could go right into the workforce just from, you know, gaining basic knowledge from taking a CTE class at my high school. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Denny, and best wishes to you. And Mr. Bonin?
Any of it works. My name is Robert Bonin. I am the one of the CTE teachers at the Fairmont High School. I have the honor of teaching automotive, small engine, a little bit of mechatronic and welding. And so when you start talking about the STEM classes, really all of those courses that I currently teach are STEM. They have the sciences behind them. They have the technology, the education, and the math components. And so, where I embrace STEM as my world, sometimes it gets convoluted and kind of goes off in the sciences and the maths and stuff. But it is very much part of our world. What I'd like to talk about a little bit today is, first of all, we'll start with our student Lucas over here. I've had great pleasure of having him through the years. He started out, and what he failed to tell you is he's taken every semester a class down in my area. A good student, and just as he said, he didn't really have a plan going into this year, kind of what a lot of typical seniors in high school, they have that unknown. The high school counselors are calling him into the office and asking him, what's your plans here? We need to start getting you, you know, applying for colleges and looking at scholarships and all that stuff. And he just didn't know. And so having the opportunity to be able to take a CTE class was important for him. What he found was his passion. I like to, you know, and I've spoke a couple of times this year, and I like to remind people that you have to find that fit for every student, and they have to be passionate about it. Once you have that, it's much easier to teach those. And so it's fun for me to be able to help a student like Lucas find his passion and then show him how to get good at it. He's put many hours into it. He's been in the Saturday welding class as well. He uses the Saturday welding class as an enrichment for him. He is able to take it during the school day, but he's also able to come in and use that Saturday to get better at his craft. He is what we used to call tradesman. He's a skilled tradesperson now. And he's failing to tell you that he's got three local manufacturers that are all large manufacturers competing to see who's going to be able to hire him. He's got one that comes into the class and has been watching him weld. And so that opportunity is there because we do have that course offering. But the enrichment side is what's helping a lot of these students. We talked about Anna last year. I sat here, and Anna came with us, and she was unable to come today because of commitments with Ash Wednesday. So she would have been here otherwise to tell you again. She's taken more of those classes. She has no plans at this point to go into any type of welding, but what she's gaining through that skill asset will never go away. And so whether or not a person goes into that trade, they still become a skilled person. that skilled person, whether they go into that trade or not, still has a an understanding and an appreciation for the trades. Many of you sitting around the table today probably hire somebody to come out and do some repair work at your house. Maybe, you know, light switches or plumbing and all that stuff. That's a tradesperson that's coming out there and doing that. And that's what we're asking for. We're asking for time to teach kids the trades. The reason for the extended time is, just as the superintendent pointed out, a lot of these kids that come into the trades area probably are struggling in a science class or a math class because that's theory-based. It's not application. They come down to my world and now it's application, and we can teach that math and we can teach that science in an area that they love. And that's one of the things that Lucas would tell you if you give him, you know, give him a chance to talk again. You can see that stuff that they were talking about in the science classroom come to life in my area. But if I can't get that student down to my area, they don't ever get to realize their passion. All they know is they hate school. Why am I taking two math classes this year? I flunked the one last year. Why am I going to school? Well, there's statistics out there that show that kids stay in school when they're enrolled in a CTE class. And in fact, the more CTE classes they take, the greater their graduation rate becomes. And so, you know, I'm very passionate about it. Why do I teach Saturdays? Why do I teach in the summer? I love what I'm doing. Why am I still here and not out at an area manufacturer? Because I love what I'm doing with the students. I'm also fortunate enough to teach through the Riverland system, a college in the school classroom, and Lucas is enrolled in that as well. So a lot of our students get an opportunity to pick up some college credits while they're out there. We do push the fact that they can go on to a secondary college. I'm not pushing every kid out the door saying, you've got this high school diploma, go be a tradesperson. They do, and I've spoke with Lucas at length about this before too, there are importance to going to that next level and learning from another teacher and learning how to become, you know, a mini adult before you just go out into the real world. But there are other kids, we know that they're not going to go to that secondary education, so how do we provide the programming in our high schools to provide them with that skill set? And that is through a strong CTE program where we are partnering with the colleges to bring that to it. So I just kind of wanted to share that point with you, and if there's other questions, I can answer.
Thank you, Mr. Bonin. You can tell you're very passionate about your job, and you do it well. I have a couple questions, and then we have one from one of the representatives. As a CTE teacher, are you a licensed teacher?
Yes, required by law. I was, you know, just like everybody else, I actually started my career as an elementary teacher and then switched into the career in tech ed. Part of that, I went through the University of Minnesota's program. As a CTE, I actually hold a CTE license and not the old industrial arts license where you could teach any area under the industrial arts. I actually hold a degree in specific areas. And so a CTE teacher does have to be licensed by the state. We do go through the same trainings that a social studies teacher or high school teacher would be, where you have to have content knowledge in addition to all the other pedagogy that we would have. So, yes, we are. There's not very many of us out there anymore. And as we alluded to, St. Cloud right now is the only school that is training in the state of Minnesota. So it is harder to find us.
And I have one more question. So if Lucas leaves school and goes to one of these three wonderful job opportunities, is there like an apprenticeship that he has to go through, or do they provide that at the industries that he joins?
So we are kind of in our manufacturing area right now. We are a non-union area.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be no apprenticeship. The skill set that he has picked up through high school meets all the criteria of these local manufacturers. We actually have partnered with three of these industries in the area. Actually, there's like six of them that we actually work closely with, and we'll share the Zerke story with you as well. But my students that come into my program, some of them will start as young as their freshman year taking classes. So they can essentially take about four different semesters of welding training. So a lot of my students actually will get more, and I don't mean to sell a secondary school short by any means, but a lot of my students will actually see more seat time than they would in a trade school at that point. Okay. So they're picking up the skill set. We actually give tests that are exactly what they would take. So when Lucas goes out to one of our local industries to take a weld test to see if he can get hired, we're actually administering that in our second class of the four series. So we have a very rigorous program. But we've built that through our community and our college connections. Zerke Built Manufacturing, which is a large manufacturing firm down in the Martin County area. They moved to Fairmont recently. It's in the Sentinel article where they talk about moving because of the welding program. They've expanded back to Winnebago because their growth is so, you know, so large right now. They've outgrown their new building. They've got 14 of my students from the last three graduating classes. None of those students had to go to a vocational school, nor would they have. I have a lot of students that do go to vocational schools throughout the Riverland system, Midwest. We send a lot of kids up to Alexandria as well. But there are a certain percentage of kids, for whatever the reason, they're not going to step foot in another institution once they graduate from high school. My responsibility is to make sure that those kids are just as well prepared as those going off to a technical college or to a four-year university.
All right. Representative Baker, you had a question?
Quick question. Superintendent Brown, looking at the cost, currently is the school district absorbing the roughly $4,000 difference in expense to the class versus the revenue they're getting for the students?
We're actually assuming all $9,000. We're getting zero revenue for the state.
If this were to go through, Madam Chair, this would help you then.
That's correct.
You're right. Thank you for that. And finally, there's a few communities that I know of are out there that are actually getting the business community to step up and write checks out for these kind of things. Have you experienced some of these projects yet in your area?
We have. In fact, let me make three points. First of all, Lucas has never failed a class. I want to go on the record. He's not one of those guys. Second of all, I want to point out that Mr. Bodine is this year has been nominated from the Minnesota Rural Education Association to be Minnesota's Rural Educator of the Year. Will be competing at the national level. If you look through your packet, Bob Bodine has a four-page packet in here. My second year, this is my ninth year at Fairmont as superintendent. After my first year, I had to cut $1.5 million off the budget. I cut 40 positions. I didn't cut any faculty, but I cut every place else. I didn't replace anybody if they left. We're now in great shape financially, however. But the second year I was there, Bob came to me and said, Joe, I've got 86 kids signed up for welding. I need more money. I need more supply money. So he asked for an additional $10,000 for wire feed and gas. I went to the school board, and they said, no, we just cut $1.5 million, Joe. He said, go out and try to raise the money. So we sent letters out to 10 different companies, and they're actually listed here. Avery Waytronics, Zerke Built Manufacturing, GKN out of Armstrong, Iowa, AGCO, which makes the Massey Ferguson tractor in Jackson, Ready Hall, Henway, Meester Machine, Artsway Manufacturing, Magnolia, Sada Dodge Center, American Welding and Gas. I went to each of these companies, sent them a letter, and asked them if they would be willing to adopt a welding booth for $1,000. And if they would adopt a welding booth, we could buy a new welder and buy some gas and wire feed, and then we would put a nice sign up in each of the welding booths to say that this welding booth was donated by Magnolia's. And we have their name, their phone number, their website, and their contact information. And then we give those companies the first shot to come into Bob's classroom and talk about their business and recruit kids. And so, yes, we have a very strong relationship. And, in fact, some of these companies, I think three of them, actually donate scrap metal to our high school, which saves us a lot of money. Here's my view. I don't think public schools can do this anymore by themselves. We have to work with the private sector. And that's the neat thing about Minnesota, is that we have so much positive evidence. Businesses want to help. They have to be asked, and they have to feel welcomed. And so I would encourage all public schools to go to the business community, ask them to partner with you. We could not do this by ourselves. Thank you. Good question.
And Madam Chair, that's all I wanted on committee hearing. That was perfectly well said, and I think it was well done. Thank you.
I represent Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Baker beat me to the punch on that question. But just a follow-up on that, and first I'd like to commend all of you for the fantastic program you're doing down there, and however we can help move that along, that's what we should do. What I've heard up there today is it sounds great. We started off talking about the amount of, you know, labors we need in all of these trades, and that is so true in the company I come from. I've been seeing that for years, just the shortage of all the tradespeople and the need for that. So I'm really happy to hear that. You guys are on the right track. You've been very good in just making it work. And so whatever we can do to support, I'd like to do that. You got on to the part about the the business participation, which I think is a crucial element of that. And I'm glad Representative Baker asked that question. But I just wanted, you know, follow up to what you were just saying. We need more of that and make it a little deeper and get internships maybe with younger students being enticed to go look at those jobs for the future and getting into those trades as well. And this will just help me get my bill ready for more teacher training, for vocational training, and appreciate all of the feedback here today. Thanks.
I'm going to answer one part that was suggested, I think. You asked about the certification, and I just want to point out that when the legislature passed the tier licensing system, the tier one license specifically, where we could hire a vocational teacher if he or she has at least 5 years of experience in the trades to teach vocational classes. And we have two important major companies in Fairmont, Day Plumbing, which does HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, plumbing, and Dewar Electric. Dewar Electric is an IBEW plant. They're unionized. Day Plumbing is not. But both of these companies, which are right down the street from each other, they're both very interested about doing a summer internship program where we would bring kids out to them. It's hard for them to come into the school an hour a day or maybe even on a Saturday. They're busy. But they need workers, and they're willing to have our students come out to their plants, their places of business, and be on site. And we could actually pay them as a tier one teacher. And that's specifically in the area of electrical and plumbing. And those are two areas that we don't have. We probably won't have for a while unless we continue to grow. But here's an example, once again, of us being able to take advantage of the flexibility that past legislatures have done. And I know, as a former teacher myself, how sometimes interesting the whole Tier 1 and Tier 2 and Tier 3 and 4 license is. However, this is one area that, for vocational teachers, we've got to do something. And we can't wait 4 years. I'm telling you, we cannot wait 4 years. We can wait like a few more weeks and hopefully get something done. I'm not patient anymore, am I, Representative Bennett? Okay, I'm done.
Can I speak real quick?
Sure, and then I think we're going to move on because right. We want to make sure we move the bills today.
Yeah,
too.
I just wanted to touch base on the we didn't quite answer the apprenticeship. We do partner with our businesses, and we actually have one of them that actually comes into the school every Wednesday and works directly with the students and deals with the directness of what they would see on a daily basis. If you look in the packet, we talk about the benefits. We are taking our students out to the industry as well so that they get that type of training. So it's actually in that packet you have that does talk about the benefits. So that's all I wanted to touch on.
Thank you, Mr. Bonin and Superintendent Brown. And I'm sorry I was out of the room. Did the student that was here get a chance to testify?
Yes.
Wonderful, and I hope your foot or leg heals fast. Representative Poppy, would you like to speak more towards your bill? Because I don't think we have any more questions. I want to make sure we get it on its way to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the support.
Thank you. So House File, I'll renew the motion that House File 692 be moved to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? House File 692 is on its way to Ways and Means. Now, next up, we have, and maybe the testifiers can stay in case there's any further questions, Representative Bennett's House File 246. Can you maybe briefly, Representative Bennett, just explain how yours is a little different? I know Representative Poppy's dealt with more of a specific program, but Representative Bennett, if you could just go over how your House File 246 is different.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Poppy's bill and mine are very similar, except the way it's funded. And I'll just go into that. But before I do, I want to say that I had the opportunity to go and visit the Fairmont schools on a Saturday morning and to witness their class firsthand. And it is amazing. You can hear the passion here. Well, it's for real. What I loved especially about that was that they have all ranges of students there, from the struggling students who are having to retake classes. As Superintendent Brown said, they're kind of in the danger zone and of even dropping out, and yet this hooks them into school. That's one thing. And then we have the Annas, who I met there, and then she came and testified last year because I actually carried this bill last year. And she's, you know, a high flyer student and like this young man right here. And what a way to get various students together and enrich and hook kids into school. So that was one thing I noticed. The other thing I noticed is they have students from other school districts coming. And what I thought was, I got my watch dinging on me here, what I thought was what a great way for school districts to work together. It's not cheap, as you mentioned, to run a program like this. There's a lot of specialized equipment. And so Blue Earth students and some others can take advantage of that when it's being offered on a Saturday. So it's a great way for districts to share resources, another super thing. So just briefly, the extended time revenue is the way Representative Poppe's bill funds this, which I actually started with when I started this bill last year. But because the department had issues with funding it through that way, I moved it into more of a grant program. So, and Chair, could we maybe have Mr. Strom just give a very brief bit of information on what extended time revenue is, because I think that's important.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, extended time is the part of the school funding formula that provides an additional amount of revenue up to an additional 20% time for the students. MDE's objection last year to the extended time program expansion to include these kinds of activities was that under current law, extended time is primarily for remedial activities. And MDE at that time was concerned that they didn't want to expand the program to enrichment activities as well. But essentially, extended time revenue provides additional funding for students in need of support.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Strom. And that's good to know. And I actually support either way of funding. I just want to see this get funded. But the pros, I think, of extended time are that that funding is going to always be there. It won't be every 2 years in a grant that you have to continually apply for. And the negative part would be that's more meant for struggling students who are trying to catch up. And we don't want this to be a tracking kind of thing at all where, you know, all the students who can't make it are going to come on Saturdays. That's not what it should be. So I think as we weigh this as a committee, it's good to think through all these things. At the same time, I'll get one little plug and then I'll be done. I think that extended time really should start working toward being more proactive instead of reactive. Right now it's for catching kids up. Why not get them hooked into school through a program like this before they fall behind and keep them there so they graduate? So I do see it as a really good way to, in a way, remediate ahead of time. So I just would love to see this be funded, whichever way we choose to do it as a committee. I just think it's an exciting program and hopefully a model to move out into the rest of Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Member questions? First, I have to move your bill. Would you like to move your own bill, actually? The intention is for it to go to Ways and Means, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I move House File 246.
Representative Bennett moves House File 246 to go to Ways and Means. Members, are there any questions? Representative Bierman?
So just so I'm understanding, we heard these three bills together. So the three of them will be taken together, and then will they be merged, the best of all three, and how does that work?
Representative Bierman, that's a good question. We're sending all three to Ways and Means, which they'll be then sent to Education Finance, and the Education Finance Committee will have a crack at it and try to decide which the best route to go is.
All right, thank you.
Any other member questions? I renew the motion for House File 246 to be moved to Ways and Means. Any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion is approved. And now, Representative Gunther, House File 73. Representative Baker, would you like to move House File 73? Representative Baker moves House File 73 to be moved on to Ways and Means. Representative Gunther, would you like to describe your bill?
Certainly would, Madam Chairman and members. My part wants to have the whole school to be able to recoup some of their expenses. And there's one statement about our area that's kind of a little misleading. They said that we had 2.76% unemployment. It's really lower than that today. And for every 10 jobs that need to be filled, we only have 5 people to fill them. The metro area has 5.86 people to fill them. So we really, in a way, have a negative unemployment all over the state, and we have to fill them somehow. This is a nice, easy way to do it. It gives a good, livable salary. I think it's a great program. So I think what we're trying to do now is to make it so we can even expand it more by covering some of the expenses for our school district.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Do any of the testifiers want to add anything? Superintendent Brown, Mr. Bonin? All right, I see a question from members at the table. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Brown, when you get the last of the kinks worked out of this, which it looks like you're about 90% of the way there, would you consider working with other superintendents around the state to copy this? Because I think this is the best program I've seen yet for getting kids into the trades, with working with your local businesses, the school, the local businesses, the communities. It's the all-inclusive piece that I've really been looking for, and I think you've got it pretty well mastered already. So instead of reinventing the wheel, can we get you to work with other schools around the state, please?
Madam Chairwoman, Representative, yes. In fact, I just want to put a plug in for some other. There's, I'm thinking New Ulm, Hutchison, St. Peter. Those are three schools that are not too far away from us, but all three of those have expanded their vocational programs. The other one I'll mention is Casson-Manorville. Casson-Manorville, I actually visited Casson-Manorville schools 3 weeks ago. Spent 5 hours with Superintendent Mark Matusik. Mark used to be an assistant commissioner of DNR, right? And so Mark and I spent 5 hours together, 2 hours visiting his vocational wing, 3 hours watching our wrestling kids get beat up by his. But you know what's, Representative, I'm not sure, I don't know what your district is, but you might be surprised. I mean, this is, we've had a number of districts that have come down to Fairmont, and this, it is starting to catch on. And again, I had multiple superintendents contact me when they found out that Representative Bennett had, and Representative Poppy had invited us to come up, and Representative Gunther, that, you know, really encouraging this bill. And I would guess that as you go back to your own districts, and I know you all have different districts, my guess is that there's a lot of interest in doing this. And, you know, Minnesota, I just love this state. I, you know, I've only been here 26 years, but I just, this is my adopted state. I love Minnesota. And we have so much potential by working together. But we got to get out of this mindset that every class has to be taught from 8 to 3. You know, there's a reason why Walmarts are open 24/7. There is. And some of our kids don't want to come to school till 10. Some days I don't want to come till 10, but to have kids, have students that are willing to come at nighttime or on Saturday or in the summer to take a four-hour dedicated class. The next thing we want to do, we've rebuilt our Ag Academy. We've rebuilt our Welding Academy. The next focus our board is focused on is rebuilding our Construction Trades Academy. And but to have, it's ridiculous to have kids come down to a shop and spend 47 minutes in a room. You know, by the time they come down, get their safety gear on, do their project for 30 minutes, take their safety gear off and clean up, it's time to go back to class. We need to be thinking about four-hour chunks of time, 6 hours, 8 hours. We can only do that on summers and on Saturdays. And this type of bill will let us do that. And I'll guarantee you it will pay dividends for the business community and our economy. So, but thank you for the support. And anything I could do, I'd be glad to visit your district. Where is your district?
I'm Representative Barr.
Madam Chair, St. Francis is the one that I've been working with the most, and I'm talking to them about this, and they always seem to have a problem with it, even though we just bonded for a new Votech Center. I would like them to see more interaction with the local shops or the local facilities in the area for training and teachers, and actually work with the students like you have, where they can go over and actually work in the summer right in the plant, so they can graduate high school and go right into the trade and have a good paying job when they graduate.
Madam Chairwoman and Representative, my phone number and email address are on the top of that handout. Have your superintendent contact us.
Thank you. We make all kind of wonderful connections here. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And let me say it's very heartening to me to hear superintendents talk about flexibility. I think that's a very good thing. And also, I spent 5 minutes with Mark Matusik today.
Oh.
But what I really want to talk about is Hutchinson is in my district. I think I've mentioned before, they're doing great things there, not just with vocational education, but also offering support services for their students. And I think it might be a good idea at some point if we could arrange a little trip to Hutchinson. That's probably the closest of the places that you're referring to.
And they have Tiger Path.
Right, Tiger Path, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Excuse me.
I have to look that. Oops, I'm – what?
Somebody just poked me.
yes.
He said – Representative Grunhagen said it's in his district. Well,
both of ours.
Technically – no, it's in my district.
Now we know why you sit next to
you. Technically, right. We share students –
okay,
the actual building is in 18A.
I want to make sure we get back on track so we have a lot more bills today. So any other questions at the table? Representative Bennett, final word.
Madam Chair, I'm actually not giving my final word because I want to leave that for Representative Gunther. But
oh, sir.
I just wanted to add one thing here. I wanted to thank these people for traveling up from Fairmont because that's quite a distance. And then I just wanted to ask the committee a quick question. Who would like Superintendent Brown to come argue for your bills? Because he is great at this. I think you should. You lost your vocation of salesperson, too. So anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Gunther, would you like to do your final word?
Well, it's Madam Chairman, it's really great to have a person who is a former legislator argue for his bill that you're carrying. So it makes it very easy, and it also makes me a little proud to see somebody like Mr. Bonin, who used to be one of my carry-out boys in my grocery store. And it makes you feel good to see the successes that you've created.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Gunther. With that final word, I renew the motion to move House File 73 to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? House File 73 is on its way to Ways and Means. Now I'd like to reverse back on the agenda to do House File 1982. Representative Christensen. Members, just as Representative Christensen's going up to the table, I'm hoping we get through this and House File 1422 before we have to recess, and then we'll come back tonight. We'll be in room 7, at 7 in room 200. So, Representative Christensen, would you like to move your own bill? And the intention is to go to general orders.
So moved.
Representative Christensen moves House File 1982 to general orders. General Registry. Sorry about that. And Representative Christensen, I believe you have a DE3 amendment in front of us. Would you like to move that amendment?
Help me out.
Representative Christensen moves the DE3 amendment before committee. Would you like to explain your amendment?
I'm off somewhere else. We've done a delete all. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. We've done a delete all on a prior bill. And so this is our 1982 is the new language that we're including in this bill.
The DE3 is the new language.
DE3, right? I'm sorry.
So members in your packet should be the House File 1982 DE3 in front of you. And Representative, I've moved that the DE3 be... House File 1982 be amended with the DE3 amendment. So we have the DE3 amendment in front of us. And why don't we get the bill in the shape the author would like, and then we'll move on to describing it. So House File, so the motion right now is the DE3 amendment, to adopt the DE3 amendment. Any discussions at the table on the DE3 amendment? Seeing no discussions, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The DE3 amendment's adopted. Now the bill's in the shape the author would like, so I will let you proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. Each year, Minnesota school districts must meet a minimum of 165 days for students in grades 1 through 11, as well as meet a minimum number of hours of instruction per grade span. School districts do their best to plan the school calendar to cushion for weather-related interruptions. This year has been a challenge for school districts. They're doing their best to make up for lost days and hours. However, the increasing number of closures is making it difficult. Districts are looking at attending schools on holidays, staying longer in June, or taking a day or two from spring break vacations. HF 1982 will provide options to school districts that are bumping up these limits, and they would welcome some clarity about options for the school calendar, as would parents and employees. It is important that this legislation pass quickly. Those important decisions are being made now, and we need them. We need to give them, the stakeholders, flexibility and options. I've received many emails, as possibly you have, from folks in districts, and they are really looking, families are looking at being able to planning vacations, et cetera. So, I think it's important that we move this along. I brought with me testifiers. So first we can hear from Denise Pontrelli, superintendent of the Stillwater Area Schools. You want to go first? Okay. Excuse me. I'd like to introduce Valerie Dosslin from the Minnesota Association of School Administrators.
Ms. Dosslin, will you please state your name for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dosslin. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. We appreciate your time today to hear House File 1982, and thank you, Representative Christensen, for your work on this. I also just wanted to add the other education organizations that you're used to seeing here, such as AMSD, MREA, MSBA, are also in support of this legislation, but there's another hearing going on in the Senate, so I'm doing double duty today. As you heard Representative Christensen say, school districts are working really diligently right now to find the time in their calendars to make up for the lost days. And there's a lot of creative ways that districts are doing to add up for lost time. Some you've probably read about. They're adding minutes to each day. They're shortening spring breaks. They're meeting on holidays. So, for instance, one school district is meeting on Good Friday. Or they're using planned staff development days as student contact days now to make up that time. And really, some districts are running out of options. I'm here today to urge you to pass this bill quickly. I often get questions during session about what's happening. This issue is the question I have gotten the most in my tenure at the legislature. I hear from someone every day what's happening with this legislation. We need to know so we can make decisions. So I'm here to urge you today to pass this bill quickly. The legislation not only provides some districts with relief from the required minimum number of days, it provides clarity for school districts who are trying to arrange their calendars. The legislature must act quickly to allow districts to make these decisions. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Dosslin. And Representative Christensen, your next testifier.
Okay, now I'd like to introduce Denise Pontrelli. She's the superintendent of the Stillwater Area Schools.
Ms. Pontrelli, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Denise Pontrelli, superintendent for Stillwater Schools. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. There are a lot of days where I love being a superintendent, with the exception of inclement weather when I have to make a call on school closures. Just about any other job sounds better than that on those days. Calling a snow day is never an easy decision. Many of you have your own students or families who have been through this process, and this year it's been even more challenging than ever just because of the extreme amount of weather that we've had that's been impacting our schools. Not only do superintendents have to weigh the health and safety of our students and our staff, we also have a loss of critical instruction time. We also consider the financial impact if we fall below required hours and the impact of our families if we have to make up those scheduled days. We do build snow days into our calendars, but we don't build 7 days into our calendars. Snow days disrupt family schedules, but also impact our learning that's going on in the classroom. This year was especially disruptive because we had winter break and then came back for a week, and then our students were off for a week. So it really interrupted the flow of learning that's happening within our classrooms. In Stillwater this year, we lost 6 full days due to extreme weather, and then we had 1 late start. We've already made up one of those days because we are running out of options. We brought our students back on President's Day, and we are looking at a grading day on March 29th and then Good Friday on April 19th, which some of our families are frustrated with. If we have additional snow days, which I'm happy to say Saturday will not be a school day because it sounds like we have more weather coming in, we'll have to look at additional measures. Our students also graduate on June 1st, so for us, adding school days at the end of the year just isn't a viable option. Folks ask me, well, just change the graduation. When we have over 700 students, it's hard to find a place that you can just change the graduation date. And so that also is not an easy task and not a solution for us this year. Makeup dates are being held on our professional learning days. And in Stillwater and other places, when you're trying to implement many of the initiatives, some of the things that you talked about just earlier, even with career and tech ed, with social-emotional learning, we're really working on early literacy, dyslexia, social-emotional learning for our students. All of that time is lost. And so we aren't able to work with our staff to be able to move those initiatives as a school district along. The other thing it impacts is our paraprofessionals, our custodians, food service. All of you know that to make a school district run to serve our students, it takes more than our teachers. It takes all of the people around the table. And so we're fortunate in Stillwater that we've been able to work with those employees to make sure that we take care of them, because if you suddenly are without a week's pay, that impacts you as a family. And so I'd really encourage you to consider those as you do this work. When we do make up those days, as I had shared earlier, we end up making those days up on days that families have already had plans, and several families have said, well, if we use those days, President's Day or Good Friday, our students won't be in school. And I know your objective and ours is to have students in school as many days as we can. Representative Christensen's bill would forgive 3 days for us this year, which would help us out greatly. If approved, we wouldn't have to hold those makeup days on March 29th and April 19th. We could use them as intended for professional learning, which again is very important for our staff. We'd also have one day of flexibility, which I'm hoping we don't need, but I'm concerned that we might. We know that this year's weather has been very unusual. I've been teaching over and in education over 30 years, and I've never seen anything like this. It's truly unique. So this bill is a one-year reprieve from weather, and the weather, as you all know, is completely beyond our control. In the future, how are we going to plan? Well, Stillwater, like many districts, is looking at alternatives so we don't face another year like this. Early learning days, you've already heard about from other superintendents. They're a great idea, but again, you have the issue of access. So districts are working through how we might implement those within our districts, knowing that technology is sometimes an issue. So for us, timing is of the essence. Stillwater, like many other districts across the state, are already trying to make up those days, and there are fewer and fewer options available for us. We appreciate your leadership to have this conversation to support all districts across the state, and we thank you for consideration as superintendents.
Thank you, Superintendent Pontrelli. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill?
Is Scott McMahon here? Okay. Okay, I'd like to introduce Scott McMahon, who's here with the Minnesota School Bus Operations Association, and he's going to talk a little bit about how our weather cancellations have affected the school bus world.
Mr. McMahon, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott McMahon. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. We are the private companies that contract with the school districts to safely and effectively transport our kids to and from school every day. We operate across the state, heavily in greater Minnesota, but we do also have a presence throughout the metro area as well. One of the things that that folks may not understand is with the way our contracts are with school districts, when school's canceled, the vast majority of our operators aren't compensated for those days. So, you know, we build in with our contracts with the schools an assumption of there are X number of schools, the district set aside money for those X number of days, we assume that we're driving for those days. We acknowledge that there are snow days that happen, but we also understand, you know, that we need some flexibility in the situation. Subdivision 3 of the now amended bill encourages our private contractors to pay their drivers for these three snow days that are being forgiven. And the situation for those three snow days, we're not being compensated by the school districts for those cancellations. So what we're being asked for is for us to dip into our pocketbooks to pay our drivers when our clients that we're working for, the school districts, aren't compensating us for those situations. These 3 days account for almost 2% of our revenue on these contracts. And when you look at a school situation where we have, you know, five snow days, you know, three polar vortex days, we're looking upwards of 5% of our revenue that we have been expecting from the school districts aren't coming into play. We do acknowledge that there are some school districts that that do step forward. Some of them will compensate us 25% for snow days. Occasionally we'll see a school district that will give us 50% for a snow day. But the vast majority of times, we aren't getting any compensation on those snow days. So, you know, we acknowledge that in, you know, Subdivision 2, the school districts are being encouraged or instructed to either find opportunities for their employees who were uncompensated on those days to find additional days where they can work to make up those hours, or if they can't, for them to find a way to pay their employees. But the bill doesn't lay out a similar situation for us. You know, if we were to get revenue from the school districts, we would happily pay our drivers. And in many situations, we're trying to figure out how to make them whole. But when we're talking, you know, 3 days in this bill, five, 6 days of snow days, you know, we've had some areas where we've got 10 snow days already. We're having a really hard time finding the revenue in our buckets to make these things happen.
Thank you, Mr. McMahon. Is there anyone else in the audience? Let's see if there's some member questions. Mary Kushpadin.
Oh, if you wouldn't mind just staying for a minute. How many employees do you employ through your busing service, please?
So we're the association. So we have a number of school bus operators across the state. Most of our members are local companies. You know, they're based in, you know, Community X. They provide the bus services for those companies. They're small, for the most part, family operations. And when I say they're family operations, they're owned and operated by a family, and we view our employees as part of the family as well.
Madam Chair, Judy and Paula?
Yes, please. Are these employees contracted through the school year? Are they paid hourly, or how is it a per drive sort of contract? Could you explain that for us, please?
Sure. So we have a number of different ways that we structure things with our drivers. We have contracts with the schools, so we're dealing with the school year. We, in addition, will have additional contracts with the schools to deal with sporting events, field trips, community events, and so on and so forth. They are school buses, and so our buses don't generally have a purpose outside of school functions. If any of you have ever tried to sit as a 6-foot-tall adult in a school bus, they don't work well for anybody that isn't a student. So, you know, really when we're looking at the industry for the school bus operations, we're dealing with the contracts with our local school districts. Our employees are hourly-based employees. We contract with them through the school year. We also acknowledge that we have other opportunities for them. We do have opportunities in the summers for them to do additional work, you know, summer camp, transportation, things like that. But it really is, the bulk of the work is the school district, school calendar, transportation of students.
One more follow-up, and then I've got a few more on the list.
And so do these employees have full benefits so that there's, like, PTO, or would there be a way for you or for them to put some money away so that, and I don't even know if this is just an idea, so that when there are situations like this, they could tap into those funds and use them that way?
You know, our situation as drivers vary from company to company and from driver to driver. Our companies, in the way that we budget for the school year, we acknowledge that there are going to be school days, so we try and hold back some revenues knowing that we're going to have, we live in Minnesota, so we know there's going to be at least one snow day, mm-hmm. especially in greater Minnesota, that's going to creep up. But we also know that under the way things happen, that we have to account for about five of them, and then we know that we're going to kick in on rescheduled days. So we kind of know what the framework is that we're dealing with. With this bill, the framework that we've known as kind of the standard situation is being blown up, because we're not only dealing with the forgivable days that exist, we're adding three additional days into that calculation. So the numbers that we've been looking at and assuming in our budgets to deal with drivers are looking quite different under House File 1982 than they were when we negotiated our contracts with the districts a year or two ago.
Thank you, Mr. McMahon. Representative Scott, you had your hand up earlier. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for the record, I grew up in Iowa, and I remember having snow makeup days and doing half days on Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it was brutal. It's just absolutely brutal. Madam Chair, is there a fiscal note on this? I know we're talking a lot about kind of paying for days that we were or weren't in school. So I'm just wondering if there's a fiscal note on this or if one's been reflected.
Yeah, Representative Scott, not to my knowledge, because the districts already have the money. They've already been paid for those days, but I'll let Mr. Strom explain it further.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, a fiscal note is in process. We don't have a version we're able to release yet. For school district funding, for the regular funding, the snow days don't matter. They do matter for the extended time funding because the hours come into play there. So there's sort of two separate issues with the bill. On the funding side, the things that matter, there's an early ed special education that's hourly based, and there's extended time. And those two both key off the hours of service. The extended time has a minimum hours of 1,020. So if a district fell short of that, the extended time maybe wouldn't start till day two or three of the summer session. So there's a financial impact on schools there. Whether or not the department on the fiscal note will have a zero fiscal note or not isn't clear to us yet. Our guess would be likely not because that money is already built into the forecast, but I can't say that until we see a fiscal note. The second part of it is school districts are required, regardless of the funding, to go the 165 instructional days. So there's a separate requirement that the board have that number of days in its calendar, that it can't go below 165 days. But that's not connected to the regular funding. The regular school year funding would be unaffected if the district fell below the 165 days.
Representative Scott, I'll help you. Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we've answered most of my questions over here between us. But I've got just a couple of points. One on the school buses, it says that they are encouraged to compensate. So we're not mandating that be done.
And you're reading that accurately, Representative Rudolph.
Yes. And I was just going to comment on the Stillwater's reluctance to hold school after graduation, and I understand that there would be reluctance to do that, but where I taught at New London Spicer, that's what we did every year. We'd graduate the seniors, and then we had another several days of school. So it's possible to do that, but I do think that we need to do something with this. I think it's a big problem for our school districts.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. I don't know if Ms. Pontrelli wants to I don't know if we have to answer anything there.
Have to answer.
Okay, nope. All right. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I basically was going to point out the same thing. Maybe you want to put some clarifying language in Subdivision 3, Line 2.4, to make it just a little bit clearer. That's just a suggestion.
Yeah.
So that districts know that what the situation is with the contracted, because it's more than just bus drivers. Some districts have custodians and also cooks and contracted also.
All right, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Christensen.
Madam Chair. Included in the bill are the paraprofessionals, custodians, the cooks. Those are the instructional day employees, so they are only paid when they are there working within the school building. So there are some of those, the paras, for example, well, all of them actually, who ended up with 5 or 6 hours during 1 week of work when the snow days are there. So those are also, we've paid attention to them also in the bill, so they'll be compensated.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Any further questions? Representative Baker.
Just a quick question. Because there's a fiscal side of this, where is this going next?
Representative Baker, we're not sure if the fiscal note will come back with anything, and we've heard loud and clear from all the school districts around the state how important this is for them to have clarity immediately. So we're moving it right now to the general registry, and we will await the fiscal note. But
so we'll know that when it comes to the House floor, Madam Chair.
Mr. Shum, what do you think we could expect the fiscal note?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, we're hoping very soon.
Thank you.
By the time this gets to the floor, the fiscal note should be in hand.
Yeah, and I think, Representative Baker, the sense of urgency is because many of the districts are starting to bump up against their spring breaks right now where they'd start adding in hours. So I know it's already moved to the floor in the Senate or in the other body. Oops. There's a strong sense of urgency around this bill. All right, any further member questions? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 1982 as amended move to the General Registry. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion, House File 1982 is on its way to the General Registry. Representative Baker. We only have 5 minutes and have to clear out of this room. So,
Madam Chair, I think we'll be okay.
All right. Then we will follow the member's lead. Representative Baker, would you like to place House File 1422 move 1422 before us to be possibly laid over?
And I would, Madam Chair, and I also want to present to you an amendment that I've shared with you and the committee administrator earlier. It's being passed around right now. What the amendment does, members, is shorten this bill up so that it's a very short window of time. School districts really have a two-year window to execute this training, and so that is what's coming around to members. It's just a one-line strike. So I just want to present that, and I appreciate the oral amendment allow it to be happened, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The oral amendment is that exactly that. It's past the 24-hour deadline. I am comfortable with that. Normally, I would look over to Representative Erickson to make sure she was comfortable because she's the lead. But I will look to Representative Erdahl then. Are you okay with us adopting an oral amendment for Representative Baker's bill?
I certainly am.
Thank you. So, Representative Baker, and this is our first oral amendment, so I have to make sure I'm doing this right. So, Representative Baker would like to adopt the oral amendment on line 2.17, comma, strike 2020-2021 and insert 2021-2022. And 2022-2023, comma, and strike, and later. Ms. Parra, is there anything else I need to do with that? Madam Chair, no, but I'm happy to read it back for the record. Ms. Parra, that would be wonderful if you would read it back for the record.
Madam Chair, the effective date on line 217 then would read, this section is effective for the 2021-2022 and 2022-2023 school year, period.
Thank you, Ms. Parra. Representative Baker, would you like to proceed? We have an oral amendment before us. Any further discussion on the oral amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The oral amendment's adopted. Representative Baker, would you like to describe your bill and what we've just done to it?
I sure will, Madam Chair and members. Thank you. We know we're under the time crunch, and this is the kind of bills I think most members love to carry, is when you get a constituent that writes you a letter that moves you to want to write a bill. And we have a great story here today with Ms. Ruth Schmitz, someone that has taught me a lot about what a seizure is and what it looks like. And I want to also thank Representative Bierman for going to class training with me early one morning with the Epilepsy Foundation. And we learned a lot about this stuff. So because we're short of time, we're going to move along. But I want to make sure Ruth has enough time to just kind of tell her journey and why we're here today, Madam Chair and members. So thank you.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Ruth Schmitz, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to share my story. I've had epilepsy since I was born. I had the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck when I was in lack of oxygen to my brain resulted in epilepsy. So I've had it since I was born. As a young person, seizures were an everyday part of my life. Most of my seizures happened during the school year and often while I was in school. House File 1422 is important to me because it fell to me to educate my classmates, my teachers, and how to respond to my seizures. Like many children that have epilepsy, I became a self-advocate at a young age. When I would awake from a seizure. I had many eyes staring at me, the eyes of my friends, the eyes of my classmates, and the eyes of my teachers. I knew I was different. I felt the label and the stigma that goes with epilepsy. I had to educate all my teachers from kindergarten through my senior year, and I continue to educate it now as I'm in college. At the start of every school year, I made a point to tell my teachers, yes, I have epilepsy. I have complex partial seizures. I told them what to do when I have a seizure. I told them I may knock my books off my desk. I may fall to the floor. But know when I do these things, it's because I'm having a seizure, not because I'm misbehaving. And no, I don't need candy. I had one teacher who offered me candy in his drawer in case I would have a seizure. How safe would it make you feel knowing your teacher didn't know how to respond? In kindergarten, we had a class story. While my teacher was reading her story, I had a seizure. I fell over and landed on a scared classmate, and I started making noises, and my arms were moving. My teachers had not seen a seizure before and was not taught how to respond. If we have seizure recognition and response training in all Minnesota schools, we can ensure that all students are safer and more accepted. If House File 1422 was in place when I was a kid, I wouldn't have had the anxiety of educating both my classmates and the people I worked at the school. I would have been able to focus on my education. My parents would have been at ease knowing the school knew what to do when I had a seizure. Thank you for the opportunity for me to share my story with you today, and I urge you to support House File 1422.
Thank you, Ms. Schnitz, for sharing your story. Representative Baker, did you have any further testimony?
Yes, one more quick testimony.
Thank you. If you could keep it under a few minutes so we can get to questions and move on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Baker, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Heidi Fisher, and I'm the Executive Director for Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota. Our organization represents over 54,000 Minnesotans, including 7,400 children who live with epilepsy. I come to you today to support House File 1422 because we believe this bill is critically important, as children can have serious injuries or even die if as a result of improper response to a seizure.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Fisher. And I think we have two other people sign up if they want to come down. Deb Murr and Valerie Dozler. Please state your names for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozlin. It's my lucky day twice in a row, so I appreciate your attention. And I appreciate Representative Baker's time to talk with us today. Gary Amoroso and I met with him to raise some concerns. And we completely recognize the challenges that the advocates of this bill are advocating for. But there are already mechanisms in place for school districts to address this issue, and it's through 504 plans. And I'm certainly no expert, but I would defer to the School Nurses Association. They can maybe add some information to that. But there are things that families can do if they agree to a 504 plan that the districts can put in place to recognize training. All of the things that are addressed in the Baker bill. And as a matter of fact, I did some research last night, and the Epilepsy Foundation has a sample 504 plan for students with epilepsy, which is very similar to the language that you saw on the bill. We do have some other kind of practical questions about what this means. The bill requires all employees to be trained, not just teachers, not just principals, but we're talking about food service workers, hourly bus drivers, hourly school-age child care workers. When does that training happen for them? And also just, you know, we're adding on an additional time of self-study for the teachers. And all of those things are built into teacher contracts for professional development and training. And so those are a lot of unanswered questions. And then I do just have to add, you hear from us a lot about unfunded mandates.
And we've had a lot of bills this year on mandates. And while there's gray areas on a lot of things, and you've heard me here before talking about some of the requirements that have been come before us that we haven't necessarily raised concerns about, but I cannot let one of our last hearings on bills go without saying this. This is a great idea. It's an important issue. I had a mom who had hypoglycemia. I was in a car when she was driving when she had a seizure. It's very scary. But you add this idea, you add another idea on top of all of the new ideas that we keep hearing about. It's important to remember what school districts are required to do. If you just look at the education statutes, there's three over. I did a review this summer where I read through the statutes and wrote down everything that said a district must, a district is required to, or a district is shall. The list was 310 Excel rows long. And that doesn't include the special ed mandates that are in statute, the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act, any other employment law, continuing contract law, or any other statutes outside of the education code. And it doesn't include rule and law. So I just ask that whenever a mandate bill comes before this committee, they consider the context of all the other things that school districts are doing. And then I do just want to add today, I asked the superintendent about this legislation, and he said they are taking more and more time away from the requirement that they provide education to add expectation upon expectation. So we are happy to work with the advocates, and I'm happy to continue to talk with Representative Baker, but we do have concerns about the bill.
Thank you. And Ms. Moore, did you have something to add? And then we're going to move on.
I'll try to be quick.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I am Deb Mayer. I am the Health Services Coordinator for School District 196. That's the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan School District, as well as the President for the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota. And we are all about, we're in education. We all came into education to support students and increase access. Is one of the things that nurses bring to the table with that access to education and equity. And one of the things that I think needs to be considered with this language in the bill is the training. And what we feel is important for the student and supporting that student in their education isn't necessarily what's identified in the language that is currently in existence. And I would love to collaborate with you, Mr. Baker, and families with the Epilepsy Foundation on trying to figure out what makes sense for students and for schools. But right now I don't think we're quite there. I think we can get there. Licensed school nurses do this every day and figure out which staff are working with the students directly, and those are the people that we make sure are trained to be able to support them in our schools. We create that community of support. So any questions for me or thoughts on collaborating with school nurses, I'm your person.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. I think we will go to members' questions quickly. And then we are laying this over, and I know Representative Baker said he will be willing to keep working on it. So, questions? Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm certainly concerned about mandates, too. But perhaps something in situations like this, and I do think we need to do something, because as a teacher, if someone had a seizure in front of me, I wouldn't have known what to do. But I'm guessing that there are probably, rudimentary, links that we could view that would at least put us somewhat at ease. And so perhaps for some things like this, a link could be made available to the school districts who would then require their teachers to look at it.
Thank you, Representative Riddell. Representative Bierman.
And I'll just, Madam Chair, I'll just add also thank you, Representative Baker, for bringing this forward and inviting me to the little training. That was eye-opening, and I'm not sure what training is going on in my district for not only nurses but schools, so I'd be interested to learn more. But I think the suddenness of a seizure in a classroom with a teacher who may not know and students, the awareness needs to be brought forward in a big way, especially with the number of kids who are prone to this. And also just the whole, what I learned about epilepsy itself, the many stages of it. So I think it would have to be more than a link where you kind of invite teachers to go look at their convenience. It's got to be more thorough than that. So I applaud the attention and bringing the bill forward.
Thank you. Representative Greenpin and Representative Hewitt, you get the final word.
Madam Chair, Representative, real quickly, would this be required in your, in what you're thinking, in all schools that receive any kind of public funding that goes to Catholic schools? I think we're missing a whole thing. Is that what your intention would be with your bill when you, if you, if this goes through?
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, I think this is, this would qualify for anybody that the state has purview over for this. Again, the idea was to get a very short window of time. That's why I shorted it up, because I'm sensitive of the census. But I just think it's forever, whoever we have authority over that we provide money to, that's who that would apply to at this point. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Representative Baker. Did you have a 30-second final word?
Again, just committed to working on this, because it did come up mid-season here. But this is really also, members, for folks that, for kids who have not yet had their first seizure. But when you get in middle school, and by the way, hormones start working, and they start moving around, and that's when, a lot of times, this is the first time a student might have that. They don't even know they're going to have one, but if the teachers and staff are a little better prepared, they'll be better prepared on how to help the kids, but also how to teach the other kids that aren't staring all the time at what they didn't see, what they don't know. That's it, Ms. Madam Chair, and we'll move it along. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. House File 1422 is laid over as amended, and we are in recess until 7 o'clock. Folks, please put your bills we haven't had back in your folder, and if you can separate out your papers, that'd be great, so they can clear this room in 5 minutes. Thank you. I call the meeting of the House Education Policy Committee to order. Please take your seats. Thank you guys for being patient about the recording. We're going to make sure this is recorded for the public and not just live stream. So we are going to start with Representative Wazlowicz, House File 566. You want to approach the table, and why don't you go ahead and move your own bill?
You are moving it. Wazlowicz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 566 to Ways and Means.
Thank you. And I see that you have a DE2 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move a DE2 amendment.
Members, the DE2 amendment is for the member to get the bill in the shape she would like. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The DE2 amendment has been passed, and now the bill is in order. Representative Wazlowicz, why don't you go ahead and describe your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill requires schools to have school safety assessment teams, and essentially what these teams would do is if there is any threatening or concerning behavior that is happening at the school, that they would be able to convene this team and talk about the concerning behavior and think through some ideas for how to connect students to the resources that they need to try and address some of this behavior. So it's a more nuanced approach. We've heard a lot about not wanting to suspend and expel students, and I think this team idea is a way that we can try and address some of those concerns and really take a more nuanced approach to when we have some concerning behavior from students. So that's kind of the general idea of the bill.
Thank you. And I think we had a little bit of testimony, or we had a letter in our folders before from Ms. Sue Abner-Holden from NAMI with some concerns because the governor's language in his policy bill did not have all the amendments that they had discussed. And she might be back later tonight to be able to speak about it. So I'm wondering if we should start discussion. Do we know what time if Ms. Sue Abner-Holden's coming back? Or okay.
And I do have a testifier as well.
Wonderful. Why don't we bring up your testifier first, and then we'll move on.
Madam Chair, Dr. Christine Keeneland is here to testify in support of the bill.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good evening. My name is Dr. Christine Keeneland. My first name is K-R-I-S-T-I-N-E, and my last name is K-I-E-N-L-E-N. I am a forensic psychologist, and I have a consultation business for threat management. I consult with corporations, colleges, and a few schools, but primarily my work is with colleges and corporations. Today, I do want to mention that I am testifying also on behalf of Captain Randy McAllister, who is a huge supporter of this bill and driving force. He cannot be here tonight because he is in Wisconsin doing a training on stalking. In 1999, we had the Columbine High School shooting. 15 people were killed, 21 injured. In 2003 was the Ricori High School shooting in Cold Springs, Minnesota. 2 people were killed, 2 students. In 2005 was the Red Lake High School shooting. 10 people were killed, 7 injured. And in 2012, we had the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. 28 people killed, 2 injured. And last year, just about a year ago, we had the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. 17 people killed, 17 injured. And then countless numbers of individuals traumatized by these events. These cases represent just a fraction of the K-12 school violence in the United States. In response to the increase in mass shootings in the past 13 years, the FBI impaneled a blue ribbon team of experts in 2015 to examine prevention and found that by far the most valuable prevention strategy identified was threat assessment. So that is the idea behind this bill. The school safety assessment teams are threat assessment teams. Likewise, the U.S. Department of Education has recommended threat assessment teams as a best practice since 2002. That's 17 years ago. Threat assessment is a multidisciplinary process and means of identifying, assessing, and managing the risk of future planned violence. It is evidence-based, and it has become widely accepted as a standard of care for targeted violence prevention. At its very core, threat assessment attempts to intervene with people on a path to violence and gets them back on a more healthy path. We know from research that violence does not just happen out of the blue. It can take days, weeks, months, or sometimes years for people to act on their violent thoughts and planning. Acts of targeted violence are committed by people who have been overwhelmed in their lives, and they have multiple stressors, and often they are desperate. Threat assessment helps identify those people under stress, identify their stressors and destabilizers, and gets them help. Good threat assessment programs also identify ways to improve the overall school culture so that the school culture itself is not one of those stressors. Schools are frequently dealing with threats and violence already. High school students have shared with me that they hear jokes or nonchalant comments about school shootings on almost a daily basis. I think students are anxious about school shootings, as are parents and everyone in the community, and that's part of the reason they try to make light of it. But it's a deep fear, and it needs to be addressed. It is an enormous challenge for schools to sort out the students who are truly at risk of future violence. Some students talk about violence or exhibit other concerning behaviors but have no intent to ever be violent. They might have been seeking attention or expressing frustration, anger, fear, or distress. Other students are more fixated on violence. They have resentments or grudges, or they have serious mental health issues. In the most serious cases, the individual of concern has acquired guns or weapons and has made plans or taken steps to carry out violence. These cases are imminent risk and should be viewed as a crisis and require immediate intervention. It's very difficult for schools to determine where someone could be on a violent pathway without doing a thorough assessment and obtaining as much information as possible. I do want to emphasize that even though the mass shootings gain a lot of attention and are catastrophic and of course, need to be avoided, the threat assessment team process also wants to address and prevent other areas of violence, and that could include serious and persistent bullying that causes fear for safety, repeated harassment or stalking, teen dating violence, sexual assault, repeated fighting or threatening behaviors towards others. We want a culture where people feel safe at school. So when we think of a school or a school district establishing a threat assessment team, the team has different roles. First, they want to promote a culture of safe schools where there is no tolerance for threats or violence in schools. Now, that is very different from a zero tolerance policy that would say, for example, that anyone who utters a threat is suspended or expelled. It's different because every threat is investigated and may result in an intervention like that, but not necessarily depending on why the person is engaging in the threatening behavior. I do also want to make a point that school employees are a valuable resource, and we want to keep them safe too, and we want to retain them in our schools. Schools are a workplace and experience the same types of workplace violence issues as any other workplace. National standards for workplace violence prevention were published in 2011, and they recommended threat management teams for workplaces. OSHA already requires employers to provide a workplace free of known or foreseeable dangers. Workplace violence is one of those recognized dangers. Training is essential so that school threat assessment teams have a structured, systematic process in place for assessing and intervening with school violence. The threat management team can connect the dots by examining information from various sources. The assessment is comprehensive and examines the interaction between the subject, the potential target, the environment, and potential triggers. Each case is unique. It is an individualized intervention plan that needs to be developed. While some students may be placed on a suspension due to threatening or violent behaviors, in most cases, expulsions can be avoided with a thorough assessment and interventions for the student. There are many interventions that can occur within the school setting, but some cases require referrals for mental health treatment or social services outside of the school. As the school shooting in Parkland, Florida highlights, removal of the concerning person from the school does not necessarily remove the threat. However, the threat assessment team can engage in long-term monitoring of concerning cases for signs of escalation and need for further intervention. I do want to explain that there is an internal school district threat assessment team, or in some cases a high school might have their own threat assessment team, but sometimes the team needs to consult with outside professionals. So it could be the individual has mental health problems or disability issues, and the school wants to consult with the outside mental health professional to evaluate this further and to determine how that may or may not increase risk. And of course, when someone intends to carry out violence or there is imminent danger, law enforcement intervention is needed. And also legal consultation is needed to protect the rights of students and employees in some cases or when those really difficult questions arise. We are aware, Randy McAllister and I have testified on a bill like this before. Last year we did. And we are aware of groups or individuals who have raised concerns about threat assessment. And respectfully, let me assure you that some of the points raised are largely based on misunderstandings of what threat assessment is and what it is not. I want to emphasize that threat assessment does not profile and it's not punitive. Threat assessment is a behavioral approach. It's not focused on demographic variables, for example. Threat assessment is actually the opposite of profiling, since it is emphasizing an individualized and contextually relevant approach. Virginia implemented the first statewide K-12 threat assessment mandate in 2013. The Commonwealth of Virginia has studied the results of threat assessment teams in these schools. And their studies have found that with the threat assessment process, there are lower rates of suspensions and expulsions. There's a decrease in incidents of bullying. There's an increase in reporting from students when they were concerned about a classmate. And the schools have climates where students feel safe so that they can focus better on education. The studies have found that disciplinary disparities have been eliminated between minority and white students when they examined the threat assessment process. And there was a reduction in negative disciplinary outcomes for special education students. Another issue that has been brought up by people concerned about this bill is that they feel that having threat assessment teams could be redundant for schools because there are already crisis management teams. I do want to explain that these are different teams. Crisis management teams are reactive, and threat management teams are proactive, and it's a preventative early intervention approach. Both are important, and they may overlap in some areas, and the professionals on the teams may overlap, but they are different. And I will make a point about workload. Concerns have been raised that implementing threat assessment teams is going to create more work for schools. Schools are already dealing with threats and violence, and they take an enormous amount of time to deal with these situations and to come up with interventions. And so the idea is teams will be trained, and they'll have a more organized process in place, and they'll be more systematic, and they'll do things consistently across cases, which will save time. But also it's a team process, so the team shares the work, like, for example, record keeping. Also, I do recommend that if the state does pass this bill, that we consider following the model of Virginia's policies and procedures and guidelines. They have put a lot of work and research into them, and I don't think we should recreate the wheel. And finally, it has been suggested by a few that having mandatory threat assessment teams in schools could open the door for litigation. Now, liability is a very complex issue, and many factors go into that. But I think it's more defensible to be able to explain that the school had a research-based systematic process in place that was fair, objective, reasonable, and timely. The alternative is sometimes schools are making decisions without enough information that can have bad outcomes. Also, I think there's a risk of a wrongful death suit if a school doesn't have a trained threat management team process when this has really become the gold standard across the country, and this is forward moving. After the Virginia Tech shooting, most universities and colleges across the country and Minnesota established a threat management team process. However, this has not really happened with the K-12 schools since the Newtown school shootings. I ask you to join the states of Virginia, Connecticut, and Florida in requiring threat assessment in school districts so we can take real concrete steps to improve the overall health, safety, and well-being of the schools. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Keiling. Representative Wazlowick, do you have any other testifiers?
No, Madam Chair.
All right, I think I see Ms. Grace Kelleher's on the list to come down and testify. Do you want to approach? And then we'll have Ms. Sue Abner hold it right up. Yes, that's awesome. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every locally elected school official in the state of Minnesota. And I'm going to start out with the good news, Madam Chair. This bill is better than the bill we had last year. There are some provisions and some thoughtful considerations that we want to thank the author in doing. We feel like you heard some of our concerns, but I want to point out just 8 items. I'll be through with them really quickly that I want you to consider when looking at this. First of all, threat assessment teams are presently being done in schools. This is not a need for another law when, in fact, that any school district can do it right now. Second of all, I want you to consider there are very diverse school districts across the state. Not every district has over 1,000 kids. Some even have 200 children total. So this model needs to be flexible enough to incorporate those dynamics. As we move down, I'm going to just pick out specific items. On 1.112, we used a public safety school safety center. We talked about that one last night. There are 3 individuals there, and if, in fact, they're going to provide good quality advice to every school district and charter school around the state, it might be beneficial to have more than 2 deputies and 1 chairman. Moving on to number 2, if you look on the bottom on 1.24 through 2.2, there's a whole listing of individuals who can be on this safety assessment team. Our question would be, as you look on 2.1 and 2.2, are they all school employees? Are they community members? Because if we are adding outside people to evaluate every threat that comes forward in a school district, having community members come in, there is either a cost to that or a time commitment that could be large. And what if, you know, is there a structure to that that might be more beneficial? Going down to number 4 on the list, if you look on 2.8, the words there are dealing with guidance to parents and students. And if you look at that second line, we're looking at threats to the community. Now, I think a school district is going to have a pretty tough time establishing a threat to the community when, in fact, law enforcement is much better equipped to do that going forward. Moving on to page 3, we once again on 3.11, the educational records and the health records, I mean, there's not a tremendous amount of medical information unless that child has a 504 plan or an IEP, and to only use that kind of data isn't going to give the threat assessment teams very much to work with. So we'd like to work on that going forward. Once again, we have data practices issues, and I, Madam Chairman, would love nothing else if this committee could fix that so law enforcement and school officials could have clear conversations about families and children back and forth. Present Minnesota law does not allow us to do it that way. So in saying that law enforcement you know, it needs to be involved. And I'm sorry, I misspoke, Madam Chair, because as I read that sentence, this is actually one part of the bill that's right, because we only use those if, in fact, we have a law enforcement piece, and I'm glad that the author picked up on that. I appreciate that going forward. And number 8 on the very bottom on 3.27, I am extremely concerned about people who go into the education field and paraprofessionals and administrators that we have in our school district having enough training to go from an educator to someone who can evaluate a threat assessment. As you heard from that doctor previously, she's very knowledgeable and understands those pieces very well. But I think you're asking a teacher to teach and educate a child and then at some point be able to also provide what is a threat and what is not. And last but not least, Madam Chair, and I know we share this with the discipline policies, we are really concerned about having that if a child is named a threat or brought forward, that there is some kind of review or appeal by parents, and if, in fact, does that continue for their whole lifetime at school or at some point can you be a safe child and go forward. So with that, I appreciate the author's willingness to listen, and especially the committees at this late hour, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Representative
Weslowick, did you want to answer any of that before we have Sue Abnerholden come down, or would you like to have her come down first?
I think I will, just a couple of the points. I think to your point about teachers needing to have a lot of training, I think that's why the team model is as it is so that you have some folks with expertise in some of the areas. So it could be mental health, it could be school counseling. And the hope is that, you know, everyone gets the training, but then you have folks who have more expertise in these sorts of issues to hopefully provide some of that expertise to lend that to the other folks on the team. So I don't think know that that addresses your concern entirely, but that was kind of the idea behind a team model.
Ms. Keller, did you have something to add?
Madam Chair, once again, I'll just go back to this great state that you folks get to set the educational policy for. It is very different. If you have a school district of 200, you might not have a counselor. You might not have a social worker. So some of those pieces that are really easy to find here to imagine, because we've got great examples, are much more difficult to do in greater Minnesota. And I just ask there be some consideration for the expectations, because everybody wants children to be safe, regardless of their zip code.
Thank you. Ms. Abnerholden, would you like to approach, state your name for the record, and proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abnerholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And as you know, we have still a slight concern with this letter. You know, the research on this issue has really only been done in one state, in Virginia. And one of the articles that was actually provided to me about it that actually assessed the statewide implementation, I quote, said, "The inclusion of these cases, suicide, for review by the threat assessment team complicates the process and alters the confidentiality usually afforded students and their parents being seen for suicidal counseling." There's still a couple of places in the bill. On line 2.19, harm to self is still in there. So that would include, you know, any child who is suicidal. And then section 2.31, you did the delete all amendment, right? I had to run out through 3.2. So I'm still kind of confused about what happens here. So if we're really taking students who are suicidal out of the threat assessment teams, which we should, being suicidal is very different than having violent, you know, thoughts to another. We're still saying that upon determining that a student exhibits suicidal ideation, then what the school safety assessment team does. Honestly, if a teacher or another student fears that a student is suicidal, you don't want this kind of referral thing going on. We're going to call the assessment team. Who's going to let the principal know? You need to call in a mental health crisis team right then. You don't want to wait for something like that. We had actually, you know, had talked to some folks about putting together some language about what should those suicide policies be at a district level, both in terms of what do you, you know, what's the action that you would take if a student is suicidal? What happens if a student tries to take their own life on the school campus? What do you do after suicide so you don't promote contagion and things like that? But I'm still worried that this paragraph is really not appropriate for dealing with suicidal students. So two sections that we, you know, would be happy to work with the author on, but just wanted to point those out that just as in other areas of bills that are going on at the Capitol tonight, we really want to separate out suicide and violence.
Thank you, Ms. Abnerholden. Representative, have any response?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think just to the testifiers that we're more than willing to work on some of these issues. I know some of these things were just things that didn't happen in the process because of how the timeline worked for this delete all in the bill, but certainly willing to work on these issues.
Wonderful. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Okay, I think I'll go to member questions. I have Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing the bill forward, Rep. Moslick. It's a heavy lift, this one, just as far as getting your head around it. When I started to read all the issues and listen to the testifiers, there's a lot of issues here, and it seems like a threat assessment team is more than one team based on the level of the interaction or the problems that we're dealing with. Of course, you know, everything in schools, there's certain levels of threats and disruption that you have to deal with, much of which the school can deal with on their own. And then the important thing, and what I'm pleased about, is that schools already are starting to take a more active process in protecting schools and being more observant and making it a full community endeavor to protect schools, which is what we need. And I missed it the first time, but I did see on 2.1 to 2.5 that law enforcement was included, and I was looking for that. But it also jumped out at me that if you're really looking at the safety of school from a serious, like, we talked about various things there, but a gun threat or something, you know, you need to have, I think, a board like that. Also, there should be parental participation. And I know it was brought up that that will bring its own issues dealing with schools. But I think, you know, parents, schools, the kids, law enforcement, everybody has a role. And then, of course, counseling, which is kind of the main thing we need to have. So I just was trying to understand if there would be in these teams a certain structure of school-based planning, which is going on now, and then where does that widen out to permit more mental health specialists, more safety, law enforcement participation, et cetera. So I think it's a really important topic, and it just seems very broad to me here and right now. And I just wondered some comments on the structure of the team or how many teams it might take to pull this off.
Representative Bosley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bierman. I think the idea for this is that it's one team, but I think you're pulling people, as was mentioned, that there are other groups working on these issues in a school already, so you may have some crossover with some of those other folks. I think the idea is that, we include the language to the extent practicable because we know that some schools in some different areas of the state may not have all these folks, so we want to ensure that we have a team, but that we leave it kind of open as to the school itself and the school professionals there to have a little bit more say in who's on that team. And then also for varying degrees of whatever might be the case, if it's a school in greater Minnesota, if they feel the need to involve law enforcement or not. So we're kind of trying to leave more of that up to the schools to decide what does their threat assessment team look like, but trying to kind of align with the best practices that have been proposed as well.
Thank you. Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was wondering, just in practicality, how does this work, the assessment team? I mean, someone, is it identified as having a potential problem? Do they bring that student before the team? Do they talk to other people on the faculty and bring them in? How does it work?
Representative
Boswell. Madam Chair, I'm going to have Ms. Keelan come up and talk a little bit about that.
Well, I would like to explain. We have a core threat assessment team, and you know, typically there's going to be school administrators, someone from counseling or mental health. If there's a school resource officer on the team, that's the core team. But we want to build awareness among schools so that everybody understands we want a safe culture, and if you see something, say something, you know, report to a trusted adult. And so there's another level of building awareness with all school staff so that they know to report concerns and who is on the threat assessment team. So sometimes how it plays out, and then also students know who to go to if they have concerns. So it may play out that a student goes to the assistant principal and expresses a concern that he heard a peer talk about having a gun and wanting to shoot a teacher because they have a grudge. Then that assistant principal, of course, if it's sounding like an imminent threat, may have to act right away to think about safety of that teacher. And different administrators go into play in managing the situation immediately, whether or not you have a threat assessment team. But if there is a threat assessment team, you're not going to wait to act until the team convenes and looks at everything. But they will convene at some point and look at all the information that was reported. If they need to, they'll bring in other school staff who know more about the situation to bring in information to the team. If it's not fully documented, they might have more questions for them. But it's the core team that goes through the systematic process of considering what do we know about the threatening behavior, what do we know about potential intent behind it, about actions to act out violently,
the core team ultimately makes the decisions and decides if they're going to pull in outside professionals. But we want all school staff to know that if there is an immediate risk, they can act immediately and not wait for this team process to go into play. But what happens is you have to think about risk and level of concern over time, because it can change depending on all kinds of variables. So you have to anticipate things that could happen in the future and what could be triggers for violence, and that's another job of the team, thinking ahead. So does that help somewhat?
No, Madam Chair.
Representative Rudolph Paula?
Yeah, I think that is helpful to me. Just wondering, would the possible individual be called before the team to talk to them?
No, not in most cases. The team is working behind the teams. The individual would likely be called to talk to someone with school administration, or it may be the school resource officer, or, in the most serious cases, maybe the police gets involved. But then that information flows back to the team. The team may decide they need more information and decide how to get it. So it could be interviewing certain teachers or students that know something about the situation, or talking to parents. So then different team members may take on tasks to get more information, collateral information, and then bring it back to the team.
Right, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am on this Public Safety Committee also, and there is a bill going through there that addresses the Minnesota School Safety Center. It's a revolving loan bill that goes through, and I think it's pretty permissive that school districts can decide to tap into that money. So they do go into buildings and assess. It's under the Homeland Security umbrella, and every 2 years they get refunded. So it's a revolving loan. So they go in, and they don't just limit it to active shooters or someone that's violent or anything. They even look for what happens if there's a storm. What do your exits and entrances look like? If there is an active shooter, what could you do with your windows to improve? To dim out your windows or all those guys. I mean, they're the professionals, I'm sure. So, however, it's their group is small. But experienced, years of experience that they've had. So I can see where a team would be important in a school, a team of human beings that are in the school. I just think there'd have to be a lot of collaboration and seeking of knowledge through the Minnesota School Safety Center, through the Homeland Security programs that the Department of Public Safety does pass every year. So that would be an important collaboration, I think. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I applaud the intention here. I know we're none of us want to see anything bad happen at a school district, especially a shooting or something like that. But I do think it should be, I kind of identify with some of the concerns that have been shared both by Ms. Haber-Holding and also by the MSBA, Grace. And, I just think if it's a good idea, if you make it optional, school districts that want to incorporate it and make it work will. But if it doesn't fit for their school district, then and they're doing things well, the way they've got it structured for their district, then let them alone. I mean, it just, these are highly trained professionals, these superintendents and administrators. I have a lot of respect for them. I've seen them operate, and they have a deep commitment to caring about the staff and the students. And sometimes when this one-size-fits-all legislation comes down, it actually impedes their ability to implement what they know works or has been working versus what we up here think is best for everybody. So I don't doubt your intentions and your good heart, and None of us want to see that happen. I do think making it optional and seeing if districts want to incorporate it is the best route. And then to see, because if it's a good idea, you're going to have a lot of districts incorporate it without a mandate. And if it isn't that good, they'll take the parts they want and they'll leave the parts that don't work for their district. So that's my observation after 16 years on the school board.
Thank you, Representative Brunhagen. Are there any other member questions? Representative Wasilewicz, do you want to make any final comments or have your testifier, or what would you like to do?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think just, again, kind of talking about the purpose, as Representative Grunhagen said, like, this is because we want to make sure that our schools are safe for our students and our staff. And I think this is something that, you know, doesn't have a long lifetime in terms of being tested, but I think that given the amount of research that's gone into it and the results we're seeing in Virginia, I think it's worth taking a look at and seeing how we can do this in our state.
Thank you. Members, I don't see more questions at the table, so I think we will move on. So House File 566, the motion was for 566 as amended to move to the Ways and Means Committee. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no?
No.
No.
The motion has passed, and House File 566 as amended is moved to the Ways and Means Committee. So let's move on. We've got Representative Bierman's House File 1848. Representative Bierman, welcome to your own committee. Would you like to move House File 1848? It's going to be laid over.
Yes, Madam Chair, please.
Okay, Representative Bierman moves his House File 1848 to be laid over and for possible inclusion. You have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that up, briefly describe it, and we can move your amendment?
Yes, I would like to enter the amendment into the bill to make that ready. I think you all have a copy of that amendment. Would you like me to itemize it, read it, or?
Just explain what it does real quickly.
All right. There are just a few changes. It's a short bill, pretty direct. One word change on page one, line 1-1. Delete everything after completes, and line 12, delete one-year district preparation program in and insert the requirements for. And then line 15, after the period insert, the board adopted standards for the endorsement must allow a secondary teacher who receives the endorsement to teach a dual credit course offered by any eligible post-secondary institution.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. So we have the A1 amendment before us. Representative Bierman moves the A1 amendment. Do I hear any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The A1 amendment has been adopted. Now your bill is in the shape you would like before us. Why don't you go ahead and explain your bill?
Okay, the HF 1814 is a of dual enrollment instruction. This bill will create a system for qualifying high school teachers to be recognized as certified to teach post-secondary content that will be accepted as college credit for those students successfully mastering the content. So as of 2020, high school instructors will need to certify that they have the requisite credentials to instruct these courses. And the requirements are a master's degree and a minimum of 18 graduate level credits in the field of instruction. Presently, concurrent enrollment instruction lacks this baseline, and Pelsby is awaiting direction on this, so there is a common baseline so that these credits, which are extremely important to the education of our high school students and college students, will continue and will be allowed to count as college credit. I think you have also some concurrent enrollment statistics for Minnesota in your packet as well, and there are, it lists more than 30,000 students, Minnesota students have participated in this, and families significantly have saved $65 million in tuition costs, which is huge. So the number of students involved and the benefits are quite large, and so we just want to make this change so there's not a so there's a continuation of this program. And Pelsby is ready and waiting to help make sure that this can continue, and I can take any comments or questions.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Do you have anybody here to testify?
I do not, unless maybe your husband wants to join me up here.
That's okay. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify for this bill or have concerns? Oh, Mr. Heller, to this bill.
Very good.
Hi, Education Policy Committee members. My name is Rick Keller. I'm officially represent the people with print disabilities and Twice Exceptional. House File 1370, line 1.18. Regarding this bill, 1848, specific question as it waits to the Common Core catalog. So it's my understanding that the Common Core catalog aligns those course numbers in the K-12 system. Will this also align in the higher education process as well? And I guess that's basically all I really have to add is as since the American Complete Act and the quality counts is about that process as well. If that's relevant to this, perhaps somebody in the audience can speak on it. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Sorry, we're having a discussion up here. I noticed in the letter from Pelsby that they don't mind having a discussion to figure out and going through the rulemaking process. So we're trying to figure out in the bill if we're required to send it to government operations then, because if Pelsby would like to do this through rulemaking, it would have to make another committee stop. We're just checking that right now.
Okay.
While we're doing that, I have Representative Erdahl on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bierman. I think this is a good piece of legislation. I've done things over the years along these lines. One of the concerns we've had is the transfer of credits between the concurrent legislation and the various colleges and universities in Minnesota. I think that this would help that as well. But one question. So the master's degree for these concurrent teachers, in what?
So my understanding after discussion on that was master's in teaching education. So a master's of education and then an additional 18 credits, graduate level, in the field of instruction.
Madam Chair.
Representative Randolph, follow up.
Okay. Thank you. It might interest you. On Friday, I have a bill up on concurrent legislation dealing with giving tax credits for teachers getting their master's degrees who are teachers of concurrent classes. And what mine is is that they get a master's degree in one of the areas that they teach, a master's degree in what they teach, not in education. They probably already have a master's degree now.
Right.
But it's not in what they teach. This would allow them to do that as well if they wanted to. A couple of years ago, I did a bill that does give a $2,500 tax credit to any teacher in Minnesota who gets a master's degree in what they teach in their content area.
I think that's...
Thank you, Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I think that bill is a great idea, and the more the teachers can continue that education and become, learn their subject material better, it helps everybody. So if you have a bill, that's something I would sign too, please.
Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for presenting this bill. I'm going to kind of piggyback a little bit off of Representative Erdahl, but I'm just wondering, will teachers who already have their master's degree in a content area, which then meets the requirement for these credentials for post-secondary, will they have to get this endorsement, this dual enrollment endorsement, if they already have met those that criteria?
So if they have met the criteria, they would just be certified through Pelsby.
Thank you, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to be clear, then they would not have to jump through any more hoops and just get kind of a rubber stamp. Is that correct?
That, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Christensen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I understand it, I believe it's the same criteria as you would have to have if you wanted to teach at a two-year college. So that you do need to have a master's degree in your content area. In the junior colleges, if you want to go teach there as a teacher, you can. Some of them may allow you, if you have 18 credits toward that master's degree in your content area, then you can teach. And I have a feeling that's the way this is designed. Is that how you understand it? Stand up.
Sorry, I was speaking okay. Here, so you were
so,
saying
that you can have a master's degree, but it has to be in your content area. So, for example, my husband has a master's degree in biology, so he could actually teach that kind of class. It's not a master's degree in education. It's a master's degree in biology. Right. So that's how I understand the rule works.
Well, Representative Bierman, if you have some clarification, or Mr. Nolan, and I had a little familiar with this, and I'll chime in too, but Representative Bierman?
So what I had understood was that it was just a master's in teaching plus 18 graduate level credits to be qualified to instruct.
And I think herein lies the rub. I think the HLC had made a ruling a few years back or talked about it. The districts are a little confused. I've heard two different things, that it's either master's in your content area or master's in, see Mr. Nolan nodding, or master's in education. And I just spoke to a teacher today that is certified to do CIS college, because I'm concurrent enrollment. I'm assuming you're talking about college in the school Spanish, but she has a master's degree in education, not in content area. So I'm looking towards Mr. Nolan to clear this up for us, because I know there's nobody here from Pelsby. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam
Please
Chair.
Please state your name for the record.
I'm Fred Nolan, Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association. And we've been in a number of conversation over 18 months with meetings with Minnesota State at the chancellor's level, with MSBA and MASA and others, trying to work ourselves through this HLC. Appreciate the attempt at trying to help this. There's two ways to be credentialed after 2022, and that is a master's in your content, a master's in mathematics, for instance, to do mathematics concurrent enrollment, and or another master's, an unrelated master's, in 18 credits in the content. So you do have both ways to get there. I do have a concern about putting this in state law. When the last meeting I had, there was discussion, is it possible we might be able to get an extension of this deadline due to the good work people are making? And I'm not sure if there's going to be a timeline on this, that you have to have the credential. So not only does the institution, say St. Cloud State or Southwest Minnesota State, say you are credentialed to teach this, but you have to have Pelsby license. And then secondly, I wonder about the wording in line 1.16, where it says that allows a teacher to teach post-secondary college. Pelsby can have no say in that. You're going to have no one say in that. The person from HLC was very clear when she was here 3 years ago. And so it's the faculty of the four-year institution that's going to say you're credentialed. So I do understand the rationale for this was explained to me was that this would allow it to be portable when you moved between school districts. And maybe that is helpful. I would just recommend before you fully involve this, and maybe when it comes up, if it comes up in the omnibus, Madam Chair, you have somebody from Minnesota State to come and talk about this, because we are really beholden to HLC and the accrediting institutions at the post-secondary level.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan, for clearing that up. I know there had been a lot of good work being done, and I don't want to, I want to make sure that we don't screw up that good work that's being done here tonight at 8 o'clock at night. So thank you. Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to get that clarified because still a little bit of confusion over here. So, Mr. Nolan, it is possible for someone to get a degree in concurrent education without having a master's degree in their content area?
Yes, you can. That is what the Northwest Partnership is doing. That is what the statewide partnership is doing. They're providing online content courses for teachers who already have a master's degree. Now, so that they can achieve those credits beyond the master's. It's also, as Minnesota State is working, to try to be incorporated as the core of a master's in the content. We're hopeful that in the secondary education, hopefully over a period of time, we'll have more teachers with master's in the content and they won't need this additional 18 credits.
Thank you, Ms. Nolan. I think that straightens things out. So basically the bill that I am presenting, which will allow a tax credit for getting a master's degree in your content area to teachers who already maybe have another master's in education or something, would be not out of line.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, it wouldn't be out of line, but they wouldn't need two master's programs. They would need one master's plus 18 credits beyond. And if the tax credit came for that as well as getting a master's in their content, then you'd have both avenues covered.
And Madam Chair, I'm not suggesting that they have to have, but it may be that a teacher who already has an education master's degree might want to have one in what they're teaching if they were offered a credit to get it.
Mr. Nolan.
That's entirely possible, Madam Chair, Representative Earl. That's entirely possible.
And Representative Bierman, you had something to say, and then I think I have another question over here.
So I guess the urgency that I felt about this bill was that we needed to do something by 2020 so that we don't have high school students coming up and hitting that ceiling and having colleges turn down the credit that they're expecting to take with them to college at this point. So from what we've heard from Mr. Nolan, it sounds like presently, with a master's degree and 18 additional credits, those classes are viable still for college credit. So the bill could stand as it is, and then we could work on the next phase of this.
Okay. Representative Christensen, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, I suppose we don't have to belabor this, but I believe Representative Erdahl had it correct too. As far as the portability, I do think it's a matter of what the next institution, so the next college, will accept from a high school as being college credits. So those criteria that you're talking about would allow a teacher to be certified so that you could actually count those college credits out of high school. Otherwise, there have been many problems about students going after taking college in the schools, and because the teachers weren't certified in the correct way to teach that level of course, that those credits weren't being accepted. So this would solve that problem, too.
And Madam Chair and Representative Christensen, it would solve that problem, but it wouldn't be a universal fix. I know when my kids went off to college and were looking at schools, the amount of credits that certain colleges would accept varied widely, right now. And it may only get worse if we don't get this accreditation system worked out.
Okay. Representative Sandell, and then I think we'll move on, because I think we're going to end up, we don't need to send it to GovOps. I do want to lay it over, because I still hear a lot of, we want to make sure we're not affecting the work that's being done.
Understood.
So, Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just a little confused. I agree that the idea that we've been talking about and that Mr. Nolan described is a good idea. The master's degree plus 18 credits or a master's degree in the teaching field is a good idea. But I'm confused by the wording in the bill that says a dual enrollment instruction for a teacher who successfully completes a one-year district preparation program and providing dual enrollment instruction in the teacher's license to feel consistent with board standards. I don't quite understand what that one-year preparation program is.
Madam Chair and Representative, that was the amendment. Oh. That was stricken from the bill, and then you put in the amendment line, and that's gone.
Thank you, Representative Sandell.
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry for the confusion.
All right, so the motion now is to lay House File 1848 over. Is there any discussion to that motion? All right, we will do that. I didn't have to have discussion, I forgot.
All right.
So thank you, Representative
Hewitt. Thank you.
Why don't we have Representative Hewitt up next for House File 1948?
Bill's only for 196. See if you're awake.
So, Representative Hewitt, would you like to move your bill? And it's for to, I'm going to look at my notes, to lay over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's good to see us smiling still. This is House File 1940. This is a great bill. Students in an IEP, or an individual education program, that currently need help outside that program have to have the districts apply for, through the department, for an alternative delivery of any education they need outside that plan. This bill would allow them to go ahead and do this without this big application or cumbersome process. Today I have with me a teacher.
Hewitt, I just realized I forgot to put the amendment on. So you have an author's amendment labeled DE1.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They get the bill in the shape. No, it's my fault. I wasn't paying attention. So you have an author's amendment to get the shape, the bill in the shape you would like. It's labeled DE1. It's in the members' packets. And is there any, do you want to explain the amendment, or should we just, why don't we just put the bill in the shape you'd like? Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The DE1 amendment is adopted. Now the bill's in the shape you'd like. Please continue.
And, Madam Chair, I think I talked enough already. So, Mr. Claiborne from Minnesota Administrators of Special Education is here to testify about his personal experience with this situation. I'm going to turn it over to him.
State your name for the record.
My name is John Claiborne. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education. Madam Chair and members, I'm really pleased to be able to speak to this bill. Maybe we should start just very quickly with a slight primer on what alternative delivery of specialized instruction, which is quite a mouthful and out in the profession. Nobody refers to it as that. It's known as ADSIS. So ADSIS is a system of academic supports for elementary school students that is designed to try to intervene before we need special education supports for students. And it uses special education dollars with the approval of the department and a system of checks and balances to make sure we're not abusing those dollars to be able to provide academic and reading assistance to students who are struggling. These are students who we hope we're getting to early so that they will not in the future need special education supports. It's worked out particularly well. Speaking selfishly on behalf of special education directors and their staff, it requires very little paperwork. So we're able to expend our time and our energy focused on delivering instruction to kids. This program has been in place for almost a decade now, and really has worked rather well in the school districts. The challenge is that because of the original wording of the bill, students with a disability were automatically excluded from being able to access the reading or math supports that would be provided to any other student in that elementary school. So, for example, and maybe the classic example, if my granddaughter needs supports because she can't form effectively her S's and TH sounds and is seeing a speech and language pathologist for that purpose, she would be automatically excluded should she otherwise be considered a candidate for support in math or reading. This level of support, this system of supports, would be disallowed for her because she currently has an IEP. Our folks have really sort of said, you know, it makes sense if a student is on an IEP and already receiving supports in reading or in math that they would not sort of double dip, they would not access these services as well. But for a student with other issues, a student totally unrelated to math and reading in the elementary school, this would be a great opportunity for those kids. It allows us to intervene early. I've seen it operate firsthand when I was the special education director in Mankato, where we saw a significant reduction in the number of referrals that we received in the elementary schools where we put this in place, because we were able to boost kids' performance and their skill development was greatly enhanced by this. Just a slight pullback. The downside is that I had any number of special ed teachers who wanted to transfer to this program because they could spend all their time delivering instruction to kids and wouldn't have to do any special ed paperwork. So I had to argue a little bit with them about that. But we're hopeful that this is a bill that folks will embrace, and I'm certainly willing to address any questions or address anything that people might want to raise about the bill.
Members, do we have any questions? Wow, Mr. Cleveland. Oh, we got one. I'm representing.
Oh, she did this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. My question is for your testifier. Approximately how many students do you think this affects?
Madam Chair and members, it'd be very difficult. I would tell you in the elementary school that I was, you know, that we initiated the program with, we probably had half a dozen kids.
Okay.
That folks said, we want Scott or Susie to get the programming, but because in most cases they were getting speech and language supports, so they were excluded.
And would this be good for their entire academic career, or is this something that would have to be reissued over time? Any idea about that?
Sure.
Mr. Cleveland?
Madam Chair, committee members, this would just allow any student to be considered. So if they were considered in first grade and received some supports, did a great job, and were maybe exited from ANSYS services, and then maybe at fourth or fifth grade, the folks said, boy, they could really get some extra support. They're still getting speech and language services. They could still access the ANSYS programming.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this. I tell you what, anything that we can cut through paperwork sounds good to me for our teachers, our special ed departments, and so on. But I do wonder, Madam Chair, just to cover our bases, should we hear from the department on this? Are they all A-OK with it? Or might be?
Ms. Caitlin Snyder, you've been summoned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please approach, state your name for the record, and proceed.
I don't know what I'm doing.
I'm sorry. Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
I'll tell you what you're going to do. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Caitlin Snyder, Minnesota Department of Education. I can't seem to figure out how to sit in a chair right now.
I know the feeling.
The department provided technical assistance on the language that was adopted tonight in committee to make sure that the intent was clearly embodied in the bill. The department does not have a position on the overall bill language. We have had this raised as a concern traditionally about the ADSIS program not being able to have services provided for students outside of their IEP, and then anything that brings clarity to the appropriate uses of the ADSIS funding or special education funding would be appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Hedrick. Any follow-up, Representative Bennett? Okay. No. Any other member questions? Well, Representative Hewitt, final word. I think we have a trigger.
Again, thank you, committee, and thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill tonight. One last point is my testifier is from Mankato and might know somebody that's close to us here. So going forward.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So we have House File 1940, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion. All right. So before we move on to have my final bill, I wanted to do some announcements just so you guys get the lay of the land for next week. So, of course, we're meeting still on Friday morning at 8:30. 8:30 8:30 to 10, we should be done. We just have three bills that are moving to finance. It's in Capitol 120. So nice new room. We get a sparkly new room. And Representative Erdahl is assuring me that it's only 5 minutes for his bill, and he's going to bring donuts.
I did my
testimony. So that's Friday. And then Ms. Para, Mr. Strom, and I are going to be working really hard throughout the rest of this week, and with hopes of by the end of the weekend having the omnibus bill posted online. And then the deadline for amendments will be Tuesday at 2:30. So it gives us a good, hopefully, 48 hours to look at the bill and figure things out. And then Monday we're going to meet. We've got the room all day, but I'm not going to do that to you. So we're going to start at 10 a.m. on Monday and go to 3 if we have to. And what we're going to do there is we're going to possibly have two bills up that are moving to finance as well. So they will clearly, the bills tomorrow and on Monday will not be included in the omnibus bill because we're not miracle workers and can't move backwards. So then I will walk through the omnibus bill and we'll start to take testimony. And then Tuesday, we are meeting at our regularly scheduled time from 2:30 to 4 in room 5, and we'll finish up testimony. And then Wednesday, we will start taking amendments, and we're meeting at our normal time from 2:30 to 4 in our regular room. And then we'll meet again to finish up marking up the bill on Thursday. We'll start Thursday morning during the finance time in their room. They've graciously given up their room for that hour and a half. And then we'll come back later that night if we need to at 6 or 6:30. 6. So we'll try to put that all in a nice fancy email for you, but I want to give you guys a heads up so you kind of knew what was going on. So the magic number, the magic things to know is by the end of this weekend, we'll have a bill posted online and amendments will be due for the entire bill on Tuesday at 2:30. And then we'll walk through those amendments for the next 2 days and be done. So, hopefully Thursday day or Thursday night. Representative Erdahl. Monday, we're doing two finance bills and then walking through the omnibus bill and starting to take testimony. And we'll get that out on the listserv, too, by this weekend for folks that aren't right here in this room. But I'm sure the word will spread far and wide. So we should be good on that. If you have any questions at all, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. And once we finish first policy deadline, we may be having some few informational hearings. We may be pulling some bills back up and sending them out. I'm not quite sure yet. So keep on your calendars the week after our regular time schedule. And that's about all I know right now. So we get to move on to this final bill. Representative Crispin, it's gone very fast. Trust me, I know. All right, so we're going to move on to House File 1120. And I'm going to go up and give the gavel over here to Representative Crispin. All right.
Your bill, we must vote for.
Like it.
Another deep dive. Let's go again. Let's go.
Committee, we will be hearing Rep. Joachim's House File 1120, which is... Well, here's a little fun fact about that bill. 1120 is my birth date.
Oh.
Yeah. I should have carried this one.
You can sign up.
I'm always going to request that number now. And this is a bill about compulsory instruction requirements modified and school districts requiring to offer kindergarten.
All right, members. So I'd like to move House File 1120 before the committee for discussion and to lay over. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hanging out for this very long day with us. We're trying not to do too many evenings, but currently, a little background. Currently, Minnesota statutes only requires compulsory attendance in schools from the age of 7 to 17. When I first heard this statute about 8 years ago, I was shocked that children weren't required to go to school until they were 7. For the value we put into education in Minnesota, that just seems a little too late. So my bill changes that compulsory age from 7 to 6. Why? Because we need to make sure our kids are getting the best start possible. And frankly, when I check with MDE, about 98% of our students are in Minnesota are currently enrolled in our all-day kindergarten program already that's being offered. So I basically just want to catch our statutes up to what's actually happening in our schools. And another interesting fact is I was leaving my work at Aquila Elementary just this last December. I heard from many of the teachers things they'd like to have changed. One of the top two things were more funding, the special education cross subsidy, and, of course, special education paperwork came up. The other thing I heard was this. Why don't kids get to school at 6? All our kids are doing that anyway, and the few that don't are so far behind. So there was a little plea there amongst Aquila teachers to make that happen. So I'm here to speak for them. So let me quickly, before we have questions, tell you what this bill does not do. It does not take away parental choice. If you look on lines 2.12 and 2.14, there's still the ability for a parent to withdraw a child from school for good cause, which can include the maturity of the child. If a parent feels that their child is not ready to attend school starting at 6, they can wait to send their child until they're ready. It does not take away parent notification. In lines 2.15 to 2.16 of the underlying bill, you see that when a child is required to enroll in school, parents must be given this statute and notified about the provisions of their right to withdraw the child. And in lines 2.17 to 2.19, when a parent does withdraw their student from enrollment in the public school under paragraph C, they no longer fall under what we have as compulsory attendance provision in this bill. So currently, when a student goes to school, no matter what age they start, once they're enrolled, they're compulsory, you can't say that fast three times, they're required to attend because they're enrolled. So they fall under that. And this bill would say, if they withdraw under the paragraph C, that they don't fall under that compulsory attendance. And then finally, this bill does not take away local control. On lines 2.20 to 2.23, you can see if a district has adopted a policy to exempt children under the age of 7 currently and 6 in this new bill, they just have to notify the truancy enforcement and publicly post that policy on their board, and parents can follow that policy. So this bill does not take away parent control, parental notification, or local control. All this bill does is change the compulsory attendance in our schools from 7 to 6. It reinforces our commitment to provide a quality education to those who are definitely our future. So I stand for questions.
Representative Bennett. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Joachim. And I just, first of all, I want to say I appreciate our shared goal of getting kids ready. That's so important, ready for instruction, ready for school, and closing the achievement gap and all those things. And I also appreciate the safeguards. Some of my concerns are met, the safeguards in this bill for parental choice here and so on. But I still do have a lot of concern over this because of the message it sends, and I'll explain why. First of all, my entire teaching career was primary age children, and with an emphasis also in kindergarten, early childhood, and special education. And so I worked with young children my 33 years. And the developmental differences in children, and I'm going to preface this first and then I have a question for you, but the developmental differences in children are greater the younger the child is. And I'll give you an example of when children start to learn how to walk. Babies typically learn to walk, and those of you who are parents already know this, but between about 9 months and 12 months. But the normal range there is anywhere from about 6 months to 16 or 17 months. So that's over a year of normalcy for the maturity of the child and that developmental growth. And the same thing goes for children academically, being ready to learn, being able to sit, being able to follow directions. All those things are just as developmental as walking. And it's just that we don't see them as well. Walking is, you know, much more visible. So it concerns me greatly when we're sending a message that basically children are ready at age 5 to sit in kindergarten and learn like this. There was a Harvard study that was just done or completed in 2018, and it showed that there are dangers of early school enrollment for children, and there's a significant increase in identification of children for ADHD and diagnosis the younger children start school. So I don't want to see this anymore, that we're almost forcing school onto children who aren't ready. And I know that parents can opt out, and so that's a good thing, but I think the message that it sends is a little bit dangerous, and I think we might have some unintended consequences of more kids in special ed when we're really trying to do the opposite. So my question is, have you considered those developmental issues and the impact that this is going to have on children who start school and they're too young and they're just not developmentally capable, and they suddenly get shoved into special ed and identified as ADHD and all those things?
Madam Chair?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bennett, thank you for the question. Yes, I have. I did a lot of work in advocacy work around early childhood 14 years ago, 12 years ago, just when all the brain research was starting to come out and Art Rolnick came out with his studies. And there's a reason why we all used to see those posters that said, I learned everything I needed to learn in kindergarten. The majority of our executive function and brain development happens before you're 5. Now, we also know your frontal lobe doesn't fully develop until you're about 23 to 26, but that part is so little of it that's left, it's like you're losing your last 20 pounds of weight. So most of your executive function happens between birth to 5. That's why we do our preschool screening from 3.5 to 4.5 to get to some of the exact things you're talking about. Can a child follow directions? Do they have awareness? Can they do different things and answer questions? So I think if a parent feels like their kid isn't ready, the underlying language that we're not touching, they still have the ability to not have them go. We are really behind in our country compared to all around the world of when kids start school. When I was working at Harley Hopkins, my gosh, 12 years ago, 14 years ago, I was the parent volunteer coordinator and also worked in the Little Lending Library. There were a lot of we had a large influx of women with their children from East India. And there they start at 4. And we had a huge enrollment in our early childhood and family education program in early childhood preschool because they were desperate while their families were working here before they went home in a few years, because their contracts were usually just a few years, to make sure their kids stayed on track so that they could so they could start school at 4. And they were in preschool because they wanted to make sure they could opt in early to kindergarten. So that's just one country. It's like that all over the world, and our kids have to be global leaders and global citizens and compete in that workforce. I just want to make sure we have that option, and like I said before, 98% of our kids are already doing this. So we're just catching that statute up. But I was very concerned, too, about the immaturity. That's why I did not want to touch any of the underlying statute that's there to give those parents that option to not send them.
Are there any other questions? I have a question for you,
yes.
Chair Yao Kim. So if a parent chooses to wait that extra year to send their student, even now, if they can wait until they're seven before they put them in, are they still able to access early childhood, like the voluntary early childhood programs? So it wouldn't be that they wouldn't be they wouldn't have access to some kind of program or educational program. It's just one that maybe is not enrolled in a formal classroom, but maybe those early childhood or preschool programs.
Madam Chair, this does not change any of those access points.
Okay, thank you. Oh, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Presently, if you're inquiring on like early learning scholarships and such, 6-year-olds are not eligible. It cuts off at 5.
For the scholarship.
But I have a bill for that too. So,
so actually, Representative Erdahl, I'm closing the gap.
Any other questions then? Okay. Well, seeing no more questions, I think we will follow Chair Yawakim's lead and lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think we are done for the evening. If you'd like to gavel us out.
We